This is Dr. Richard Barone. I'm continuing my oral history interview with Mr. Patrick Curry. Today is the 19th of July, 2005, and we are again in the Special Collections Library interview room on the campus of Texas Tech University, and it's 1:33 p.m. Central Standard Time. Pat, why don't we pick up with where we were? You had arrived down in Tainan, and you discussed some of your activities, but let's kind of start with a couple general questions about the area.
Sure.
How long were you there in this area? Was this your permanent home while on tour?
Well, it was for a few months.
Okay.
excuse me. The Combat Arms Replacement Program that I mentioned yesterday had just started, and they didn't really kind of know what to do with us. So I was after the 10 days or so that I spent touring the various companies and out on the fire base at a place called Katum, not Kantum, the city, but Katum, K-A-T-U-M, was just a battalion fire base, and LZ is all it was. We were standing out there, a couple of us standing out there one day, and just to prove that the Air Force has a sense of humor, two F-104s came over. I had my back to them, and I didn't see them, and I was kind of nervous anyway, being, you know, on TV and all of that, and they came down and came over the LZ at about 100 feet and rolled and popped their afterburners right as they got over our heads.
Oh, boy.
And, man, that was almost the end of my tour right there. scared me half to death until I saw what was going on. And then everybody laughed, but mostly at me, but certainly got my attention. But I initially started off, back in the rear. And I was first the assistant administrative officer.
Okay.
Really a terrible job.
But why do you say that?
Oh, it was kind of boring. But I was responsible for a lot of the personnel actions, administration. If we had a court martial or something like that, I had to do the administration on it. Awards and decorations was a big part of what my office did.
You mean you all typed up the citation? And
yeah, we would get something hand scribbled on a piece of paper from the field. And it was our job to turn it into a citation that we could send forward that would, number one, justify the award so the guy got it.
Right.
And number two, was suitable to be used as a commendation with the award.
Okay. Would you all try to translate as close as possible, or did you do any embellishing or any kind of, you know, making sure that, you know, this individual got that Bronze Star or that Purple Heart?
Usually didn't have to embellish.
Okay.
I mean, my experience was pretty much the enlisted guys that got awards pretty much earned them. Of course,
yes.
Purple Heart, I mean, you get wounded or you don't. But for a Bronze Star with V, or especially a Silver Star, I think the fuss about Carey's award was kind of a disgrace. I'm not a big Carey fan, but my experience has been that when you get a Silver Star, it's because you earned it. And I didn't see very many of those faked.
Right.
And I think if Carey got a Silver Star, then my God, he earned it.
Right.
And they should have backed off on him for that.
Okay.
Editorial comment.
Well, that's interesting. I was going to ask you if you could give examples of things you remember from your life, either then or now, about citations and awards and getting them or not getting them, people still seeking them today for action back then. So that's a very appropriate comment. Continue. What was the atmosphere of that office when you all were writing up these incredible acts of bravery and woundings?
Well, there was a real dedication to getting the awards through. Most of the company clerks, who all worked for me along with the S1 staff, I would say half of them had master's degrees. I mean, you know, it was the time of the draft. And almost all of them were grunts, 11 Bravos, and they had spent a bunch of time in the field and had come back to, for whatever reason, a wound or something, to take an administrative type job. And So they were pretty darn dedicated to seeing that their buddies got these awards. And we really didn't embellish because we didn't have to.
Right.
Now we prettied up the language, the grammar, the punctuation, spelling, all that. Excuse me. But in terms of adding in things that didn't happen, no, I didn't do that because I didn't have to.
Yeah, that's what I meant by that, is that all cleaned up what was written, but it was what was written.
It's what was written. The events in the little hand-scribbled piece of paper are what went into the formalized award recommendation for an award.
Whatever happened to the scraps of paper? Did you all just throw them away once you were done with them?
Oh, gosh, they're probably in the battalion files in the archives of the Army somewhere. Yeah, we filed them with the awards just as backup in case there was ever a question.
Right.
And we had one NCO, E7, and he got put in for the Distinguished Service Cross. He had gotten wounded. He'd gotten shot in the chest. And this guy was a soldier, I mean, capital S. And he's in the hospital. He went AWOL from the hospital and still wounded, of course, and managed to grab a ride on a helicopter, get back to the battalion rear, and then went out to the battalion front, and went right back out in the field with his company.
Wow.
And then the next day there was a big firefight, and he led a charge, gathered up some guys and led a charge right into the center of the enemy line, and broke it. And this is all with a severe chest wound, broke the enemy line and managed to send them, the ones that were still alive, running back into the jungle. And,
wow.
And I never did hear if he got it or not, but boy, he sure earned it. Brave guy.
What was it like to read these incredible citations, the scribbled notes, something like you just mentioned?
It's real emotional. You know, you can see, I mean, you can just picture in your mind's eye these guys out there, especially if it was a posthumous award. And unfortunately, obviously, there were a number of those.
Mm-hmm.
And they were real good about making sure that, you know, the guys that got killed got put in for an appropriate award.
Right.
And it was a pretty emotional time. And you spend a lot of time and effort writing these things and trying to make them just right, put in the right buzzwords so they'd get approved.
Right. What was the mood when you all would do this? Was it somber, or were you all kind of collaborating and, you know, standing over each other's shoulder and saying, "Hey, why don't you try this?"
No, it was pretty somber, and it was pretty much a one person job. Like I say, with the educational level in that office, we didn't have any trouble finding people that could write.
Sure.
Although I personally did a lot of the writing and did a lot of the write-ups, but there wasn't much trouble finding people who could write. But the volume was such, you didn't have time to have multiple people spending a lot of time on one award.
Right. How much time was taken up by this? What was the volume? Guesstimation.
Gosh, it was hours and hours. Probably two people full time.
Wow.
Because it wasn't a 10-minute task to sit down and write one of these. You know, you sit down, you write it, you revise it. Of course, we didn't have word processors. You know, it was pad and pencil.
Mm-hmm.
And you revise it, and then you revise it again.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe get somebody else to look at it. You know, if it's a high-level award, get somebody else to look at it, see what they think, and go from there.
Do you think people today would benefit, the American public today would benefit from reading citations such as the ones that you wrote to better understand what happened in Vietnam and to better understand the American soldier in Vietnam?
Oh, I think there's no question. Yes, absolutely. It certainly would give them a lot. It would give them a different picture of the Vietnam War than they had from the media, where all emphasis, the publicity was on the bad things that happened. There were a lot of them, I'm not denying that.
Yes.
But there were a lot of very good, very brave things too, and they didn't get a lot of coverage. And it would be really great if people could read just the little hand-scribbled notes. Because there's some company commander sitting there in the jungle in the middle of the night with a poncho over his head and a red flashlight. writing this thing up so he can get it out on the logbook the next morning.
Mm-hmm. I'm trying to imagine you all doing that, and I can, having interviewed so many people and heard so many stories about what you all must have felt doing this and the duty I would assume you all felt in this task. Tell me, do you have anything that you remember specifically from that, besides what you just related to, that NCO story? Anything else that you, when you think of that time and doing that task, that comes to mind?
Gosh, the guy who got put in for Silver Star, obviously a grunt, and they had walked into a bunker complex, and gosh, I don't remember his name after all these years, but they had walked into a bunker complex, started taking fire, everybody hit the ground, and he was hit, not badly by those standards, no such thing as a good one, but it was relatively minor, and but he managed to crawl in and to the complex and start throwing grenades and suppress fire long enough for the rest of the company to do some fire and maneuver and sweep through the bunker complex and eventually take it over.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I mean, that was just a pretty gutsy thing to do. And in my book, he was wounded. He had every excuse in the world to just lay there and holler medic. He just wasn't that kind of guy.
Guessing again, what would you say, Pat, is the percentage of Americans who served in the war and who witnessed countless acts of bravery, but they were never reported? Do you think that was high? Do you think it was, you know?
I'm sure it was. If they had tried to report every time a man acted courageously, I mean, we'd still be processing the paperwork. These guys, and I'm not saying we didn't have our 10%. I was a defense counsel for a guy, assistant defense counsel for a guy, who some VC walked into a hasty ambush, and he jumped up and ran, and before they got in the kill zone, and screwed up the ambush. We didn't get any of them, as it turns out.
Mm-hmm.
And back then, they didn't get an individual attorney. They got a couple of battalion officers
and that
appointed as defense.
That was you.
That was me.
This was one of your jobs.
This was one of my jobs. It was one of the jobs of every officer in the battalion.
Okay.
And it wasn't the first time I'd done it. I'd done it quite a few times. So.
In Vietnam?
No, in over just the course of the year and a half that I'd been an officer.
Tell me how, in Vietnam, how you were selected to do this.
It was basically a duty roster kind of thing.
Okay.
You know, it's Chandler and Curry's turn. And Chick Chandler was a guy I really want to tell you about.
Was he there at Tainan with you?
Yes. And
okay.
He was the lead guy on this, defending this guy that broke and ran. And even though everybody just wanted to strangle the guy, and everybody knew he had done it. I mean, it was obvious he had done it. We got him off.
What was this? Can you spell the name of your friend, Chick?
Well, his nickname was Chick, C-H-I-C-K.
Okay.
But his real name was Charles Chandler.
Okay.
And he and I got to be pretty good friends. He was an infantry first lieutenant, and through working on this court-martial and everything, and Chick got promoted to captain, and became company commander. And after he'd been out there a couple of months, they had a mortar attack, and he rolled out of his hammock and was crawling towards a foxhole, and a mortar round landed about 18 inches away from him and killed him. And I'm not a big fan of the Vietnam Memorial. I hate it.
Really?
I absolutely hate it. But when I was working in the Pentagon and living in Washington, and when the traveling wall comes here, I go out and look at Chick's name, and you know, somebody remembers him. Several people remember him. I remember him, and he was married probably about the same time we were, Diane and I were. He had a son he'd never seen, and so he was going to go in R&R, we were talking about, well, are we going to bring the kids on R&R? And he said, well, we decided we're just going to have this time for ourselves, not bring my son, and I'll have plenty of time to see him when I got back. And he died never seeing his son. And one of the things I really regret, just kick myself in the butt for and have for 30 years, is not staying in touch with his family. I wrote his wife and told her what kind of guy I thought Chick was.
Take your time.
And she, I've never gotten like this before. She wrote me back and said she was going to save it for her son to read. And God, I wish I'd stayed in touch with her. He was from St. Louis.
Mm-hmm. How long had you all known each other? Was it just a couple of months?
6 months.
5 months. And did you bunk together? I mean, were you there in the same barracks?
No.
He was the first lieutenant, you're second lieutenant.
Well, yeah, but I mean...
But you all stayed.
Sure. Rank among lieutenants is like... I won't finish the phrase, but it doesn't much matter. But
well, what is the phrase?
Rank among lieutenants like virtue among whores. I didn't call a first lieutenant sir or anything like that. When I made first lieutenant, I expect a second lieutenant to call me sir.
Sure.
But so we were more or less equals. He'd been in country longer, had more experience.
Why did he go to the field?
He wanted to be a company commander.
He was infantry.
He was infantry right. All the way, through and through.
Okay. Did he spend his first 6 months with you and then 6 months?
No, he'd been a platoon leader, and then he became a company XO, so he came back to the rear. Then he got promoted to captain. He went back out in the field to take a company. We had our company commander, who he's not a bad guy. He just wasn't a real competent guy. And his casualty rate was pretty high. And he just didn't have that ability to lead men in combat and do the mission without creating too many casualties. And this very quickly became apparent. And he was very quickly moved out of the field, out of the command position, and sent out of the battalion to a different kind of unit where he wouldn't command soldiers in combat. And I don't want to say he was incompetent, but I guess the evidence says he was.
And, right.
But he was sure moved out quick. I mean, one day he was there, and next day he was in a different battalion.
Was that common? When people saw a problem, did they... Well, I mean, not common that of incompetence, but common in the fact that if those who had this authority, if they saw a problem like that, they would move people out of the field. They would minimize problems and smooth it over and get it going.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And they put Chick out there to fix it. And
how many days was he out there?
Yeah, not long at all, like a month.
Why don't you, if you care to, tell me a little bit about him as a person. You're 6 months with him. Mm-hmm. I mean, just to kind of honor his service. Right now, in the moment, tell me a little bit about who he was and the work you all did together. And
well, he was just a really bright guy, mm-hmm. and just a smart guy. Mm-hmm. And I mentioned this court martial. Well, the battalion had charged this guy who boogied out with intent to avoid.
Yes.
Well, you can't prove intent. And how do you prove what a guy intended to do? His defense was he was going to a better position, and that his intent was to kill the enemy. And how could you prove it wasn't? And and you couldn't. And one of the board members later told me that 10 minutes into the court martial, they were sure of two things: he had done it. The guy had chickened out, no question. And two was he was going to get off. And he did.
Mm-hmm.
And he did. They sent him to a different company. They didn't want to send him back with his buddies. He wouldn't have,
right.
He wouldn't have made it, would be my guess.
Were there any Americans lost during that incident?
No.
He just blew the ambush.
And it was a bunch of AC, and they just turned around and pushed on back into the jungle. And as far as we know, we didn't get any of them.
So his his platoon leader or his company commander, they brought him up on charges.
Absolutely.
Of
cowardly this in the face of the enemy. And actually what they charged him with was fight with the intent to avoid hostile contact or something like that.
Right.
That's what they actually charged him with.
What was, would you say, the most common thing that you dealt with as far as a defense counsel? What was the most common incident or issue?
Insubordination to an NCO, disrespect to an NCO was the most common.
Okay.
No question.
And you had to defend these individuals?
Or prosecute.
Okay, or you could prosecute.
Or prosecute, sure.
Okay, so it was basically potluck. You were chosen one side or the other.
Mm-hmm. There was one where I was the lead defense counsel. We had an LZ Dobby, on top of a mountain, New Yong. And we used to sit up on top of that mountain and watch the Big Red One get mortared every night. But these guys were supposed to, there were four of them, they were supposed to go out and put out an LP. And they went out, set it up, and then they came back inside the wire without telling anybody. Uh-huh. And they got caught, of course. And, well, the first thing they did was tell 11 people that, yeah, we did it. So defending them was a little difficult.
Yeah.
And I tried everything I could think of to come up with some kind of defense strategy. But I mean, they had told so many people, and it was so, there were so many witnesses that I just didn't see any way. And
but you still had to defend them.
But I still had to defend them. And I talked to them all, and we wound up pleading guilty and putting their service records out there. The kind of ringleader, if you will, had a Bronze Star with V, and most of them had awards of different kinds, and they weren't bad guys. They just tried to get away with something and didn't,
mm-hmm.
And so they got court-martialed, and all of them got reduced, but the ringleader, he got sent to LBJ, Long Beach Jail, and not a pleasant place. But he got sent there for 30 days. And, of course, that was bad time. That didn't count either towards his tour in Vietnam or his time in the Army.
Mm-hmm.
And they sent him back to us again. The time he was in LBJ is when he was supposed to be on R&R meeting his folks in Hawaii. And, of course, obviously he didn't go on that.
Mm-hmm.
He came back, and about 3 weeks later he got killed. That big firefight, and he got killed. Well, his parents started writing letters to us. What happened? Why wasn't my son on R&R?
So he had not informed his parents?
No.
Of why he couldn't meet them?
No. And he had not told them anything. And they just wanted to know, why was he still in country? Because it was after his original DROS, why hadn't he come on R&R, all these kinds of things, and nobody was going to tell them what happened. I mean, nobody. And
out of respect for him,
he screwed up, but he was still a soldier, and he died, and we weren't gonna sully that memory with his family. And we brought a letter back, and they, of course, didn't satisfy him. There's no way we could satisfy him because we couldn't tell him the truth.
And your unit was responsible for writing that letter and being in communication?
Yeah. Well, they wrote directly to us. Okay. And so we had to answer directly. And Battalion Commander came up with probably 14 different things to tell them. And, but we never did tell them. Never did tell.
Is that difficult?
Oh yeah, it was real tough. Not telling them was easy.
Right. You knew that was the right decision.
There's no question. We didn't even think about it. There was never the slightest thought about telling them what really happened. And but you know, figuring out what to tell them,
mm-hmm.
was pretty difficult. Yeah.
Did you see yourself 6 months earlier? You know, I'm going to be in a war, and I'm going to be defending people, and I mean, did you know this was part of what you'd be doing?
Okay. I had done the same thing at Fort Hood.
Okay. So you expected that to continue?
That was just part of the duties of a captain and below in a battalion. I mean, that was just part of your duties.
And this continued on throughout your tour?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Well, in the second half, most of the second half of my tour, I was a company commander. So I really wasn't eligible to do that kind of thing.
So chronologically, just so we're straight, you're in Tainan, which, again, is, I don't know if we discussed the geographical location, but it is northwest of, just outside Saigon, northwest Saigon in Three Corps. Mm-hmm. And you were there for the first couple of months?
Well, I was there for a couple of months, and then they moved me out to set up an office on the LZ, on the fire base, Katoom.
Okay.
And which was basically a bunch of concertina and a landing strip, and of course a talk. But so they and I stayed out there for a while.
How long did you think you were out there?
2-3 months.
Okay.
Then when we moved to LZ Dali, and I think I'm getting this chronology right, when we moved to LZ Dali. Then I again moved back to the rear.
Okay.
In Tainan.
And that's when you were company commander?
No. I was still in 1st to the 5th Cav.
Okay.
Under the Combat Arms Replacement Program, after 6 months, I could apply to go to my kind of unit, an ordnance unit.
Okay.
And so I called the G1, which is the division personnel, and said, guys, you know, I've pretty much done my 6 months, and I'd like to go to the maintenance battalion. Mm-hmm. And they said, yeah, you did your time, and so we'll move you. And I went to the 27th Maintenance Battalion.
Okay.
And anywhere, anytime. And I was a shop officer in Company XO for, I guess, 5 or 6 weeks, and then they made me a company commander. And I spent the rest of my time there. And this was LZ Andy Quan Loy.
In Quan Loy.
And I spent the rest of my time there as a company commander.
Okay, that will help outlining that, just as far as, you know, where you were in country. Can you describe what Tainan looked like? And of course, it's dominated by a geographical feature of Tainan Mountain.
Yeah. Nui Badin. Yeah, White Persian Mountain.
Yes.
And, that engineers used to just have fits out there. They said that we owned the top and the bottom, and they owned everything in between, not the engineers, the VC,
right.
Owned everything in between,
right.
So it was kind of an interesting place.
Mm-hmm.
But
did you ever have a chance to go up on the mountain?
Never did. Tainan was kind of an interesting place. Most of the buildings were wood boards, horizontal wood boards, from the ground up to about 4 feet.
You're talking about the houses?
The buildings on the military installation of Tainan.
Okay.
And from about 4 feet up to ceiling level, they were screens,
mm-hmm.
you know, to try to get any kind of breeze that you can get, and then usually some kind of metal roof, corrugated tin or something like that. And, of course, in between every building, there was a bunker, so that you could run out and get in there. And some of the guys had taken and cut through the wall of their hooch and dug a tunnel down into the bunker. So they didn't have to run outside and into the bunker. They could, from inside their hooch, they could get down into the bunker much faster. And they would put, we had what's called PSP, perforated steel planking. I'm sure you're familiar with that. And that would commonly be the roof of a bunker with a bunch of sandbags on top. One of the cooks was running through one of those little quick hidey holes and hit his forehead right on the edge of the PSP.
Hmm.
Knocked him cold.
Hmm.
And, of course, just laid his forehead open.
Hmm.
And
is it during a mortar attack?
Yeah. And so he spent a couple days in the hospital.
Yeah. Let me ask you this, Pat. I've had many, many veterans comment upon the bunkers back at the base and how you all would get in them. And go through their routine when rockets would come in or launch come in. Did anybody take you aside when you first arrived and said, okay, Pat, here are the bunkers, and here's what you do when this happens, and here's our bunker, and this is who gets in first, you need to get in last, or every man for himself? Was there anything like that, or did you just kind of have to figure it out on your own?
Just kind of figured it out on your own. And, I mean, you learned real quick. But you just kind of watched the thundering herd and followed them.
Right.
But
is that something that you would, like when you would arrive, say, at Dolly or these other places, go, okay, and where are the bunkers? Just kind of pinpoint in your mind where they were so you would know where to go?
No, I can't say that I really did. There were so many of them scattered around that it really wouldn't, being far away from one really wasn't a major issue. Mm-hmm. I can't say. Now, not on the fire bases.
Right.
I'm talking about at Tain Inn.
Right,
rear.
Back in the rear.
Yes. And out on the fire bases, they were so temporary, there just wasn't a lot of time to build those kinds of things. But one of the big things was how do you learn the difference between outgoing artillery and incoming artillery?
Can you explain how you learned?
And
did you look and listen for?
I did, because I wanted to know the difference.
Right.
And everybody I asked said, it'll take you about 2 days to figure it out. Nobody could explain it, but they all said it'd take you about 2 days. And they were right. I was, when I first came into the first cav, I was in Foot Van at the division headquarters. And I was in what we called a BOQ, basically a hooch with a bunch of cots in it. Mm-hmm. And there was an artillery battalion not 30 yards away, or battery, not battalion, battery. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, they started shooting. Man, I didn't know what was going on. And fortunately, there was nobody else in the building because I hit the deck. And but from then on, I knew what outgoing sounded like.
Can you describe what you listen for? It's just loud at first, and then
well, the incoming off. Has got a, even if you don't hear the whistle, the incoming has got a sharper crack to it.
Meaning when it shot at you?
When it exploded.
When it exploded.
Yeah, so if you started hearing these kind of sharp cracks, then you knew it was time to hit the ground.
I guess because you're hearing a loud explosion, whether it's an incoming landing and exploding or an outgoing being shot out of the tube, mm-hmm. you know, out of the artillery piece. So you have to differentiate between the sound of those two.
Exactly. That's exactly it.
Okay.
Yeah. And it's the guys were all right. It took me about 2 days, and after that, was never any question of whether it was coming in or going out.
Did you ever get used to the noise?
No.
Okay.
No. The outgoing never bothered me, except I have some hearing loss. When at Quan Moy, we had a 175 battery right across the street. No suckers are allowed. But the outgoing never bothered me. Well, I sure never got used to the incoming.
Yeah.
And I'm glad I did.
Right, you know, well, of course.
When you get used to it and get casual, that's when you get killed. So. Mm-hmm.
I would like you at some point, and you can do this when you want to, is to comment upon you know, some incidences or experiences when you did were fired upon in the rear, and when you had to deal with incoming, and how you felt, what you did. Are there any particular things that stand out in your mind about it?
Well, it's really a helpless feeling. I mean, there's somebody 5 miles away shooting these big bullets at you, and you don't know where they are, you don't know where they're shooting at, and half the time they didn't either. And it's just really a helpless feeling. Now, if you're out on the perimeter, and you know, or if you're counter battery, something like that, you can at least shoot back. Mm-hmm. But if you're just walking through the area and it starts coming in, I mean, you're just really helpless. And that's the way I felt.
Right. Were you scared?
Oh, sure. Sure. People I didn't even know were trying to hurt me. Seriously hurt me. You're darn right I was scared. And we were in Tain Inn one night, and gosh, it was kind of the middle of the night, and all of a sudden all hell broke loose. And there were procedures that you followed, especially if you thought you were going to get a ground attack. And there would be a reaction force. Well, there was a unit right next to us. And they had a deuce and a half full of ammunition, and that was supposed to take their reaction force to the perimeter. And about, we figured about 120 seconds before 20 guys jumped on this truck, 122 hit it. And, I mean, we picked up the pieces. They picked up the pieces, you know, in a bushel basket. This thing just, and it blew for probably 10 minutes. And then the EOD spent about 3 days cleaning up the unexpended ordnance that this thing had just scattered all over Heckin. Mm-hmm. But we missed 18 or 20 casualties by 90 seconds.
Wow.
And I was in my hooch, sound asleep. I was sharing a little office, or a little room, I should say, with a warrant officer. And had a concrete floor.
This is in Tainan?
In Tainan.
Okay.
And it was the same night as the truck. And all of a sudden, these things start landing all over. And, of course, this truck blew. And, I mean, we both hit the floor and kind of rolled under our bones. And just nothing you can do but wait for it to end.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately, it did. And so we waited a little while and got back in bed and went back to sleep. Got up in the morning, and all kinds of holes in the ceiling where shrapnel had come through.
Why? I think that people, when you talk about this kind of thing, that it's for people who are listening to this who have never experienced anything close to that, how human beings can endure that kind of thing, and especially a helpless feeling, feeling of fear, self-protection, survival. How does a human undergo that, and how does a human deal with that? How did you deal with it?
Well, I mean, you just do. It's part of the environment. It's a normal part of what you're doing at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's something it's always kind of niggling at the back of your mind, but you can't dwell on it. Mm-hmm. There wasn't anything you could do about it,
right.
So there wasn't much point in fretting about it. You know, you just you deal with it. I didn't see very many guys that had lots of problems with it. I mean, a few did, obviously, but very few. I mean, I'm not sure how to answer your question. It was just there. You know, it's like looking both ways before you cross the street.
You answered it. That's how you did. Mm-hmm. You dealt with it. When you're under the bunk and you're waiting for the barrage to stop, what are you thinking? Just stop. You know.
Well, I'm thinking, damn, I hope nothing lands here. And I'm thinking I'm ready for it to quit now. And hoping that I don't get hit.
Are you thinking about family, home?
Not really.
You just don't let yourself go there?
No. You can't do that. You wouldn't be able to deal with it then if you thought about that. But
are you talking to your buddy across the room?
We're both looking at each other like deer in the headlights. I mean, all you can see is eyeballs.
Mm-hmm.
And because, like I say, there's just not anything you can do about it. When you're hitting that close, you're taking a bigger chance jumping up and running for a bunker,
right,
than you are just hunkering down. Typically, it'll explode in a V shape. So if they don't hit a roof above you and spray a bunch of shrapnel down, if they hit the ground beside you, they have to be really close before they're going to seriously hurt you. They're definitely going to damage your morale and your eardrums. But they're not really going to seriously hurt you unless they're really, really close. So you're really kind of safer when they're that close, hunkering down and
mm-hmm.
and just staying flat on the ground. And that's what we both did.
Did you cover up with anything?
There was one flak jacket in the room, and we scrambled over it.
Did you do rock, paper, scissors?
No, we both just grabbed. And he got it.
Okay.
And I used to joke with folks that, you know, if you get scared enough, you can get entirely under your steel pot. And God, we were standing outside one night, and nothing was going on. It was dark, and remember, I was standing by a Connex, and you know, the big steel boxes, and all of a sudden, it sounded like a freight train was going overhead. And S2 told us later they thought it was a 122 with a satchel charge attached. And it went right over our heads. And I turned around and flat-footed, went 8 feet you know, a Connex is about 3 inches off the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't quite make it under, but boy, I was sure trying. And that thing hit in the road on the other side of our battalion area, and it left a crater that must have been 4 feet deep and 6 feet square.
Wow.
I mean, it just, but I'll never forget that sound. It just whoosh.
Didn't even know it was coming.
Didn't know it was coming, just out of the clear blue. A bunch of us standing out there talking.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, somebody else incoming. And all you see is bodies diving for the ground.
Mm-hmm. Would you see people trying to get in bunkers and say, hey, there's no room in this bunker, you need to... Or would you all make room for anybody?
They came to the bunker they got in.
Okay.
Yeah, no, I didn't see any of that.
Okay.
It got a little cozy sometimes, but I didn't see anybody turned away from a bunker.
Were the attacks more daytime or nighttime?
Almost always nighttime. 90% plus.
Why do you think they were doing that?
Oh, they own the night. You know, we didn't do much at night. We couldn't do much at night. And we used to talk about it. You know, at night Vietnam was theirs. And during the day it was ours. But they could do things at night that, of course, they were a lot lighter and more mobile than mm-hmm. we were. So at night, that was an advantage.
Mm-hmm.
During the day, of course, that was a real disadvantage because we could see them
mm-hmm.
and just bring hell down on them. But at night, they just were pretty much moved with impunity.
Okay.
Not true anymore.
Yeah, I remember yesterday you were talking about, or the day before, that we own the night now. We have the technology to,
yeah.
to enable
Nobody that. Matches us at night now.
Do you think it's a lesson from Vietnam?
I absolutely do. I think the smart guys looked and said, you know, we can't fight another war like this.
Mm-hmm.
And I went on some night exercises at Fort Hood, and this was long, long after.
Mm-hmm.
And I had night vision goggles, and it is an eerie sensation to be sitting in a Humvee scooting along at 45 miles an hour when it's pitch black because the driver's got night vision goggles.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he can see everything.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, you can't see a thing. It's an eerie feeling.
You're sitting, you don't have the goggles.
I don't have the goggles.
So you don't see anything.
All I see is black. Because he doesn't have any headlights on. And he's got the night vision goggles. So, I mean, it's reasonably safe, but
sure.
I say it's a strange feeling.
That's,
but most of them happened at night. We had a few during the day, mostly a few isolated rounds.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing real serious.
Of all the places you were stationed while there, or posted while there, where were you receiving the most attacks?
The most mortar attacks was there at Thay Nhien. The most ground attacks is when I was up at Quang Hoi.
Okay.
We had several pretty serious ground attacks on a perimeter when we were up at Quang Hoi.
Were you ever responsible for being on the reaction force or being part of the response?
No.
Okay.
Now, they would rotate infantry units through to do that. Now, my unit would be called and given a certain sector to defend,
mm-hmm.
things like that. But in terms of being responsible, I was just responsible for making sure my guys got where they were supposed to be.
Okay.
And they let the combat arms guys, in an attack of good judgment, let the combat arms guys do the tactical.
Right.
So.
Tell me, let's talk some more about Thay Nhien. Tell me again what it was like there, and what were your quarters like, and what kind of recreation did you have, what kind of food did you have, your basic everyday life there in Thay Nhien.
Of course, it was hot. I mean, hot and wet. And my sleeping hooch I shared with another guy. And it was one of the buildings I described earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, you didn't have to worry about modesty. There were zero women around. Absolutely zero.
What about the hooch mates? Did you all have?
Illegal in the first cab. Not allowed in the first cab.
Okay.
As a company commander in Quang Hoi, I cleaned my own hooch.
Okay.
And not allowed. But, other units on Thay Nhien had them, but we didn't. But, so like I say, you didn't have to worry about modesty, so everything was open, screen doors and
mm-hmm.
all. And I had a bunk over on one side, he had a bunk over on the other side.
How about how big was this room?
Oh, 12 by 12. And ours had an adjoining bunker. so that all we had to do was run through the back of the hooch, and we were in a bunker.
Right out the back door.
Right out the back door. I mean, it was actually connected to the hooch.
Okay.
And they had the culvert, steel culvert. Mm-hmm. You'd put that over to make a little tunnel, mm-hmm. and then put sandbags over that. So you had kind of a little tunnel going into it, mm-hmm. and you could jump up and dive in there real fast.
So how big was the bunker?
Oh, 6x6 maybe.
Pretty good size.
Yeah, well, we'd been in Tain Inn so long that there had been plenty of time to do those kinds of improvements and that kind of stuff.
So the two of you could actually go into the bunker and I mean, it was covered up, but you go in there and dig out some more and
sure.
and make improve it.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
And it was nasty when it rained. That water pooled in there. And of course, it made the bottom all muddy and all. Mm-hmm. It was better than getting shot.
Mm-hmm.
So, but
how did you get assigned to room with this guy?
Just kind of random, you know, where is there a space?
Mm-hmm. Did you all get along?
Oh, sure. Yeah. We all pretty much got along.
Okay.
And I don't remember any bad feelings. We had one lieutenant really get himself in trouble. Good guy, too. I hated to see it. And he sure screwed up. He got in a drinking contest one night and took a dare. And I'm surprised he didn't die of alcohol poisoning. He drank about a half a bottle of scotch just straight down. He got out in the middle of the battalion area screaming and yelling and ranting and raving. And chaplain tried to calm him down. We thought he was going to punch out the chaplain. And so we had, of course, big crowd of enlisted men watching this officer and disgrace himself. And
what was he yelling? What was he ranting about?
Oh, gosh. This sucks and that sucks. I don't really remember. Yeah. Just screaming and yelling and telling the chaplain to get away from me or I'm going to, you know, deck you and that kind of stuff. And we believed him, too.
Mm-hmm.
And
was he armed?
No, he was not.
Okay.
He was not. And we all had our weapons, but typically in the battalion area, we didn't carry them. If we went outside the battalion area, you carried your weapon. That's first cap rule. And finally, things calmed down and all, and he wound up getting an Article 15 from the division commander.
Which was?
An Article 15 is non-judicial punishment. It's usually for officers, it takes a general officer, a general, to give them an Article 15.
Mm-hmm.
And it's basically an administrative type of punishment where you can be fined, you can be restricted to your quarters. Technically, you can be put in confinement for 14 days. Enlisted soldiers can be reduced, they can be busted, but not officers because they're appointed by DA. And Department of the Army. So he got, and you can turn down an Article 15
mm-hmm.
because it is non-judicial and because you have a constitutional right to a trial,
right.
You can refuse an Article 15 and insist on a court-martial. And but he wisely didn't do that. Obviously, the penalties in a court-martial are much more severe than the penalties in
yes.
an Article 15. And because you really can go to the stockade there.
Mm-hmm.
But so he got an Article 15 from the division commander. The XO read it to him, and I was the witness, which I thought was a little weird because he was senior to me. But the XO said, "You're the adjutant, you're going to do it." And I said, "Yes, sir." And of course, that was the end of his career. An Article 15 for an officer is absolutely the end. I mean, you just say, "Thank you very much," resign, and go on your way. There's no way to come back from that.
That one night?
One night. Mm-hmm. He was a combat vet, you know, been out in the field a long time, done a great job, and screwed up.
Does that seem fair to you?
Yeah. You know, he's an officer, he's not allowed to have that kind of lapse.
Okay.
Should have had better judgment. I mean, he's not a teenage
mm-hmm.
college student anymore, you know, he's supposed to be leading men in war.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Tell me about your course. You described it a bit, but bathroom facilities, shaving, and then tell me about mess hall.
This
is a Tain Inn.
at Tanian. The latrines were basically long, narrow buildings, maybe 20 feet long and 5 feet wide, maybe 8 feet high. And inside was a board raised up and with holes cut in it. And underneath it were half of 55-gallon drums. And that was the bathroom. Mm-hmm. And typically somebody who had screwed up would have to come by once a day and pull the drum out, pour diesel in it, stir it up, and light it. And that's just one of those odors you never forget as hard as you try. And that was the latrine facilities. Water was out of a 55-gallon drum, something like that. We actually had a shower, and somebody had put a black, I think it was an old fuel pod, on top. You fill it up with water, and over the course of the day, that black surface absorbs so much heat, you get a nice hot shower at the end of the day. And shaving your head, a little field mirror, and mm-hmm. you know, your dot kit and all of that. Mm-hmm. And now, when we were out on the fire base, I used to use my steel pot as a basin. And I mean, I know the Kevlar is a bit much better helmet in terms of protecting you, but it's sure a lot less functional in other ways. And none of us ever carried a basin. It didn't have to. Mm-hmm. You carried one on your head. And, mm-hmm. But when we were back in the rear, we'd go PX and buy a little plastic basin or something like that to use.
Okay. So you had access to the PX?
Yes. Tainan was a huge place. Thousands of guys. And in fact, we had part of the installation was the Filipinos. The Philippine Army had a big installation there.
Did you mix with them any?
I used to go over and use their facilities. Man, they had a great club. They had a rec center with a photo lab. Just all kinds of nice facilities. They really had it nice over there.
Tell me about recreation and things like that, photo labs, and just things you could do on base once you were done with your daily duties.
On the military side, on the Army, U.S. side, there really wasn't very much. Every now and then we'd get a dance troupe through or a USO show or something like that. Mm-hmm. The Donut Dollies, God bless them, used to go out in the jungle in a helicopter and talk to the guys and all. Mm-hmm. There really wasn't all that much to do. Play cards, talk, drink mm-hmm. a lot. A lot of drinking over there. And
why do you think there was so much drinking?
Oh, you know, you're lonesome. You're either bored or scared. You know, it's something to relieve the stress. Mm-hmm.
Was it a problem, do you think?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think so. There was the lieutenant that trashed his any hopes of a career, mm-hmm. and guys were pretty drunk sometimes, just too drunk to even make it to the bunker. You know, we'd get a mortar attack and they just lay there because they couldn't get up. Mm. And so, yeah, there was quite a bit of drinking.
How about yourself? Did you partake?
I did. Not that much. But probably more than I should have. Mm-hmm. But I was never too drunk to get to the bunker, I can tell you that. But yeah, there was a lot of drinking, as I suspect in probably any war under those kinds of mm-hmm. situations. And out in the jungle, of course, it was obviously a much different story. They didn't have access to that kind of thing. We would take a couple cases of beer, put it in a mail sack, throw a bunch of ice in there, and send it out on the logbird, so everybody got a couple of beers, and that was much appreciated.
But sure,
and in a way, the Army really subsidized it. I mean, you could get a bottle of pretty good bourbon for about $1.75, and of course, cigarettes were like a dime a pack or something like
that. Did you smoke?
Yes, I did. Okay. Yeah, a lot, and so. And you know, in that way, it was kind of subsidized. Mm-hmm. We had a captain who was our S4 for a while, really good guy, and he kept a bottle of Jim Beam mm-hmm. on the floor beside his bed. He'd get up in the morning, his feet hit the floor, picked up that bottle of Jim Beam, took a big old slug to get the day started. And we had a sergeant major who would, when he went to bed at night, he'd open a can of beer and put it under his bed. And when he got up in the morning, he drank that warm, quiet beer. Mm. If I hadn't seen it, I would never have believed it.
Why did he do that?
Beats the hell out of me.
That was just his routine.
It was just his routine to get his day started. I guess get his pump ticking or something. But
what about drugs? Did you see any of this interviewing? And I guess, you know, Tainan also at the fire base and then at Quan Lui.
Never saw any on a fire base. I'm not going to say it wasn't there, but I never saw it.
Okay.
Didn't really see any at Tainan. The drugs were around, but they were not as prevalent, not as common as they were later on. I first started seeing significant drugs when I was a company commander up at Quan Lui. I had a couple of guys I knew were using and
using what?
Mostly hash. That's what I found. I never found any heroin, but we found marijuana and hash, which was, I mean, if you went off the fire base, then it was just as common as, you know, dirt. And so I think I actually left Vietnam before it got real, real bad.
Mm-hmm.
But it did get real, real bad. They tried to frag my successor.
In Quan Lui.
They put a hand grenade in a bucket of gasoline with a rubber band around the hand grenade holding the pin. Gasoline dissolves rubber bands. And so had the first sergeant not found it, it would have dissolved the rubber band, the handle would have come off, the grenade would have gone off, and it was right outside where he slept.
And that's because he was strict?
I have no idea. I was strict. I was a mean son of a bitch at first. And
why do you say first?
Well, here I was a first lieutenant when I took over as company commander. I was first lieutenant, and I guess I hit 5 or 6 months in grade, something like that. And I knew there were going to be serious credibility issues, and I knew there were going to be tests. And I was right on both counts. And so we had to have an understanding between them and me.
Mm-hmm.
And the understanding had to be if I said it, they did it. And if they had a problem, then they could tell me about it and I would make a decision. And once the decision was made, that was the end of the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wound up given a lot of Article 15s at the beginning. And in fact, my battalion commander told me he wondered if he'd made a serious mistake. But after 3 or 4 weeks, the word got around, if you screw up, you are going to get hammered, period. That's the end of the conversation. No hope, no help.
Lieutenant Curry will take care of you.
Lieutenant Kearney will jump right on your ass. And once that word got around, things got much better. And then my Article 15 rate dropped really far, far down. I just didn't have to do it. They knew that if I had to, I was certainly going to.
Right.
And there was no doubt about it.
Right.
Had a really great group of guys for the most part.
We'll talk about that when we get to Quan Lui. That's interesting. I wanted to discuss what you saw, drug use, alcohol use. The alcohol use you saw pretty much across the board.
Across the board from the day I walked in country.
Do you think it hampered the American effort in any way in Vietnam?
I can't say that I have first-hand experience where I saw a guy too drunk to do his duty or something like that. I cannot see logically how it could not have hampered us.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there was so much of it. Guys walking around kind of in a daze. And
mm-hmm. Hungover.
Hungover and or drunk, and I just don't see how it couldn't have hampered us.
Okay.
I mentioned a couple of things where guys, and I'm talking 6 o'clock in the morning, are taking a slug.
Yes.
I just don't see how it couldn't have happened what we did.
At Tainan, what did you eat?
we had the mess hall, and we actually had a pretty good mess hall. And that was where I was introduced to fried tomatoes.
Mm-hmm.
I never had them before. And but we ate a lot of, you know, the eggs were powdered. Not that I ever ate them, but kind of standard mess hall fare.
The food bad or just average?
It was just, you know, it was just there. You ate because you had to. You certainly didn't eat for enjoyment, but you know, but we had we used to buy bread from a Vietnamese bakery. We get this bread in, cook it, spice it up, and it would be just full of baked bugs. I mean, you sit there looking. No. Just there were bugs in the bakery, and they got in the dough, and when the dough went in the oven, they got baked right in with it. And so you'd sit there with a piece of bread and be flecked with black spots. And you'd go through and pick them all out, and then you turn it over and get the other side. And of course, the trick was to cut the slice thin enough so you could see both sides.
Right.
And then you butter it up. And so, and God, the things we did. But, you know, it was not a bad mess hall. And, of course, out on the fire base, you usually ate sea rations for lunch. A lot of times in the jungle, you ate sea rations three times a day. Mm-hmm. Although we tried whenever we could. I had a Miramite can, which was an insulated container, probably 24 inches long and 12 inches wide and maybe 24 inches high. Mm-hmm. And you could put hot food in that, and it would stay hot for a while. Mm-hmm. And so we tried to put those on a log bird. So we could get at least one hot meal to the guys in the jungle every day. If possible, did breakfast too.
So this was while you're at the fire base at...
Yeah, I'm sorry, I keep bouncing back.
That's fine, that's fine. Okay. We're talking about general topics like food. You all were responsible for getting the food out to the field.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
Food, ammunition, everything they needed to survive. Yeah.
So this was... tell me, this was at the fire base at Khatum?
All of them. LZ, Dali, Khatum.
All of them.
Yeah.
And this was... before you went to the 27th maintenance?
Yes, this was doing 1st to the 5th.
Okay.
And we were trying to support the guys out in the jungle.
Okay. Before we talk about that, and I want to hear about how you all would do that, at Tainan, is there anything else as far as your jobs that you did? You described in detail writing the citations for the awards. You talked about the defense counsel, the prosecution, personnel action, paperwork. Mm-hmm. What else would you do?
Letters of indebtedness. At that time, the Army would try to help a collection agency or a debtor collect money from a soldier.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
From the United States?
From the United States. So if they wrote us, we had to try to do something about it. But the main part was the personnel actions and the administration, mm-hmm. that kind of thing. That was the first job I had. I worked for an infantry first lieutenant. And although I remember his name quite well, I won't mention it. Mm-hmm. He nearly ended my military career. Oh. And he didn't feel that I was... once I was moved out to the fire base, he didn't feel I was working hard enough and doing enough.
Why did he think that?
I don't know. He certainly never talked to me about it.
He just formed this opinion.
Yeah, and wrote it down. And then I was an assistant S4 working for Captain Joe Davis. And there was the S4. This was at Tainan.
Okay.
And Captain Davis was a great guy. I really liked him. And I went to him very bluntly and told him, you know, I got trashed, and I'm going to work my ass off for you and try to get you to cover that up for me.
Meaning what?
Meaning that I had a bad efficiency report. I wanted to earn a good one to put on top of it, so that when somebody looked at my efficiency reports, they would say, well, wait a minute, you got this one bad one, but look right on top of it, from a captain, mm-hmm. is a much better OER.
How often would you efficiency reports be done on it?
They are done once a year, or when the rating officer changes. So if I got a new boss, I got an OER. Or if I moved to a new position and got a new boss, I got an OER from the old one.
Right. So the new one coming in would know exactly what he was dealing with.
He didn't get to see him.
He did not get to see him.
He did not get to see him. Those are pretty confidential. Not officially, anyway, but those are pretty confidential. And the new boss didn't get to see him. But
these efficiency reports follow you around.
When I retired after 25 years, the first OER I ever had was still in my file. Now they're all electronic now, but
sure.
Okay. Now they stay with you forever. Okay. Now, as time goes on, you know, the older it is, the less weight it carries. And so as time goes on, you can you can cover up one or two bad ones. If you get a string of bad ones, you're out.
Yes.
But the old myth that one bad OER ends your career is not true, and I'm living proof of it.
What happened with that guy, the one who wrote the bad efficiency report for you? Where was this again? This was at Dahlman.
This was at Tainan.
At Tainan.
And also when I was out on the fire base at Katoom.
Same guy?
Same guy. Well, one OER.
Right.
I had two jobs. I mean, same job. They decided I would move out forward.
Mm-hmm.
And I really learned something from that.
Moving forward or from the...
From the whole experience with this guy and being sent out to the fire base and et cetera. And, you know, here I was, second lieutenant.
Mm-hmm.
Had never been an adjutant, knew nothing about it, knew very little about administration, mm-hmm. that kind of stuff. They sent me out to a fire base as a brand new second lieutenant, well, relatively new second lieutenant. And nobody... gives me any guidance. I don't have any supervisor anywhere around to ask questions.
Mm-hmm.
I'm supposed to go out there as this, you know, green guy and know what to do. Well, I didn't know what to do. You know, I did what I could,
mm-hmm.
but I just didn't know what needed to be done.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't have anybody to ask. And when I was a battalion commander, I tried my hardest to make sure that did not happen to our second lieutenants. That they were not just thrown out in there into a platoon and said, okay, lead this platoon and do this job. That somebody worked with them, somebody guided them,
mm-hmm.
Counseled them, and I did the same thing as a battalion executive officer, too. And
so he basically taught you how not to be?
He taught me how not to deal with a new officer. And it was such a traumatic experience for me that I learned it well and acted on it much later in life.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But Joe Davis, and I told him real frankly, you know, I got trashed, I want to cover it up.
He Joe said, was the replacement.
He was the, well, see, I changed jobs. I went from the S1 to the S4.
Okay.
From the administrative to the logistics side. Mm-hmm. Well, I was a little more comfortable in logistics.
Mm-hmm.
And and I did work hard for Captain Davis, and I think I did a good job for him, and he certainly took care of me.
So it worked out.
It worked out.
Obviously, you could.
Yeah, I got just a max OER from him, and the XO battalion XO. You have two officers who mm-hmm. rate you. One's the rater, one's the endorser.
Mm-hmm.
And the XO was the endorser, and he backed up Captain Davis, and so I was able to cover that up. And as you can see from the fact that I was selected for the undergraduate degree program.
Well, you're, yes.
That wasn't the reason. The reason is because when I was a company commander. But.
Right. But that report didn't mess you up at all. Do you think, Pat, just kind of as an aside, could the business world, the corporate world, or say the university world administration, could it learn from the military in this kind of efficiency reports? I know we have annual reviews, you know, and corporations and companies have their reviews of their employees. I can only assume that you would say, yeah, you can learn from this experience, and it can translate into the private sector, into the civilian life. And you have taken this with you, of how to interact with and rate those whom you supervise. And is that fair to say?
That is very fair to say.
Your
yeah.
military career in that sense has
absolutely.
Followed you.
Yeah. Okay. And, you know, that's the real good ones that just walk on the water people, and the real bad ones are easy to write. It's that 90% in the middle that are difficult to write. But if you do it correctly, especially in a civilian occupation where, you know, that's not the kiss of death, if you write it right, you can really show them what they need to focus on, what they need to do differently. And then if they do, and everybody wins, you can give them a higher rating next time. And that has really worked well for me here at Texas Tech.
Do you think the military puts too much emphasis on the efficiency reports?
No, I don't. I tell you, the system works. The system works. We went through an exercise one time. because, I mean, everybody's always complaining about OERs. I mean, especially the guys who get bad ones because, you know, the system's not fair, et cetera.
Well, that's why I'm asking, because I've heard a lot said about OERs.
Yeah, I'm sure. We went through an exercise one time when I became a battalion commander, and what they did was they took real promotion board records. The way it works is when they're ready to promote or select majors, for instance, for promotion to lieutenant colonel, mm-hmm. they'll convene a promotion board of senior officers. They will pull the records of all the officers, all the majors who are eligible for lieutenant colonel, and they'll go through them. And each member of this board rates them, gives them an overall score. And so they simulated this for us with actual promotion board records. And
as training,
as well, more as showing that the system works, just to give us some confidence in the system, mm-hmm. and we had probably 30 people in this room, and we had these promotion records, and the names and social security numbers had all been blacked out. We didn't know who they really were. Everybody has a picture, and the faces were taken out, etc. So we went through this, simulating being a promotion board, and we hit about a 98% overlap with the actual promotion board.
Wow.
And so the guys that we thought were the good guys, that really were best qualified to be promoted, were the guys who actually had been selected for promotion.
What about those who are, quote-unquote, passed over? And obviously each individual doesn't think they should be passed over, but can you speak to that? I mean, there must be a reason in there somewhere, or no?
Oh, yeah. You might have all good OERs. They just might not be as good as the guy ahead of you. Mm-hmm. And the way it works is they rate everybody, and everybody gets a numerical score. Mm-hmm. And so then they have this long list of people from rated from 100 down to zero. Well, then the Department of the Army says, and there might be 5,000 people on this list. Department of the Army says, we need 2,682 lieutenant colonels next year. So they go down to number 2,682, and they draw a line right under his name.
And that's it.
And that's it. Now, if number 720 resigns or gets court-martialed or otherwise ineligible for promotion, number 2,633 gets lucky, you know, because it'll drop down one more.
Right.
That kind of thing. That's how it works. And it's not that somebody who gets passed over is necessarily a bad guy, although if you get down to the real bottom, yeah.
Sure.
But not necessarily a bad guy. Just don't have as strong a file as somebody else. The kind of assignment counts. You know, I mentioned being lucky going to a division.
Yes.
As a lieutenant working with troops. I mean, that's the assignment you want. Company commander, they used to weight your assignments. A command position was weighted 3 times as much as a regular staff position.
Appropriately.
Appropriately. Like. Much more difficult job, a lot more responsibility. Yeah. And a command in a combat area was rated higher than that.
I was going to say, did they put weight on the fact that you were doing this in country, in Vietnam,
absolutely,
versus doing it in, you know, non-wartime?
Absolutely. I came back, and at that time, you really needed about 3 years of command time. Vietnam counted 2 for 1, and I came back and commanded for 2 more years.
2 years for, 1 year in Vietnam was 2 years.
I commanded for 6 months at Canada's a year.
Gotcha.
Of command time.
Yes.
And I came back 2 more years in the States. It probably didn't do me 1/10 as much good as 6 months in Vietnam.
Do you think that's why a lot of officers are real happy when a war crops up? Not happy that the war is happening, but it's an opportunity?
They certainly see it as a career opportunity.
As well, yeah, as that's what they're trying,
sure,
to do.
Absolutely. You know, that's why we're in the Army. If you want to fight a war, you should not be in the military. I mean, that's what the military does.
Okay.
You know, that's why they're there. I will say, I think that the emphasis on me and my career in Vietnam was way overdone.
You saw that.
I saw that to the detriment of the troops and the detriment of the war effort and the detriment of the Army. You know, the idea of having a battalion commander, an infantry battalion commander for 6 months, mm-hmm. and then rotating him out so some other lieutenant colonel can get a chance is ludicrous.
Just to have that experience.
Just to give them that opportunity for promotion. You know, that guy gets in country. If he's good enough to get selected for command, leave him in there for the full year. Hell, about the time he gets warmed up and figures out what's going on, he rotates out.
But wasn't this the common thing? 6 months here and 6 months
there? Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was the thing.
Yes. So, and that was not a good thing in your
opinion. It was definitely not a good thing. I mean, how'd you like to change bosses every 6 months? New guy has to come in. He has to learn the people. He has to figure out what's going on. You know, at best, they had been in combat in Korea or had a previous tour in Vietnam, but not as a battalion commander. And I think that was totally ludicrous.
While we're on this subject, this is something that I usually save until the latter part of the interview, but while we're on this subject, tell me what you thought about the one-year rotation policy. You know, this is different from Korea. It's different. Well, Korea was a different situation altogether, the quote-unquote police action, but it's very different from World War I, very different from World War II. It's very unique in the American experience in the 20th century. What did you think about it then, about the one-year rotation?
Boy, I liked it then.
Yeah.
I don't think it was good military judgment necessarily.
This is now hindsight.
Hindsight.
Okay.
But I sure liked it then.
Why now? Why do you see it now as not such a great idea?
The same thing, the experience factor. You know, I had just about learned to be a pretty good company commander when I derosed. In fact, battalion commander asked me if I would extend. And a lot of guys did, and I told him if he'd pay my alimony that I would extend.
Said, see you later, Curry.
Yeah, pretty much.
You're out of here.
Yep.
Okay.
Hit the road.
Okay.
But and that's a true story. We really did go through that.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
You and Diana, or you?
No.
And you and your
man, the battalion commander.
The battalion commander.
Yeah, he was a terrific guy. Yeah. When we get to Kwame, I'll tell you about him.
Okay. Okay.
Amazing guy.
So tell me a little bit about what when you move from Tainan up to the fire base, and then you're to Dali. How do you get around country? Are you flown? Do you take two
yes.
cabs?
No, no. The first cab is an air mobile division. Every unit has what's called an MTONE, which is their modified table of organization and equipment. It tells you what equipment, among other things, what equipment you're allowed to have.
Mm-hmm.
And as an air mobile unit, the first cab had no 2.5 ton or bigger trucks on their TONE. Now we had some just as a special allocation because the little ones, you couldn't carry enough ammunition, enough food, mm-hmm. and so we did have a bunch of 2.5 ton trucks. I never drove in a vehicle between one town and another, or one fire base and another. We flew. Now, resupply, I had guys that would drive down, pick up a bunch of parts or supplies, and then drive back.
Right.
But any personnel movement was by aircraft.
How'd you like flying?
Oh, it was fine. I hit a ball in the helicopters. And I got an air medal. When I was in 1st to the 5th, went on several combat assaults.
Did you really?
Yeah.
Why?
And,
this is after your 10-day initiation?
Well,
visiting
both.
Everyone?
Both.
Both.
Okay. But mostly during that 10-day.
Okay.
And so I went on a bunch of combat assaults. Not a bunch, but several.
Right.
And I don't want to exaggerate, but that's an interesting sensation.
Tell me about that. What is it like to be on a combat assault and the Vietnam verb, as I call it, a combat assaulted into an area.
Mm-hmm.
What is that like from your experience?
Well, typically there's been an artillery prep beforehand, so the ground is kind of smoking,
mm-hmm.
And trees are burning and that kind of thing because they put in a bunch of artillery. And you're in a helicopter with four or five other guys, six other guys plus the crew,
mm-hmm.
and you look around, there's a whole bunch of other helicopters around you. And they tend to come in and descend very rapidly, trying to make less lucrative target. And sometimes they would land, actually touch down on the ground. Other times you'd be standing on the skids. They would hover above the ground, mm-hmm. and you would just jump off. Mm-hmm. A lot of the pilots didn't like that, because if the two guys didn't jump at the same time, the weight would skew.
Sure.
And that was a bad thing, mm-hmm. with that long rotor blade on top. Mm-hmm. But a lot of times that's what we did. And most of the time when there was a logbird, they would hover and throw things out and then take off as quickly as possible.
Did you go with the logbird a lot?
Yeah.
Did you go out with the materials, the supplies?
Yeah. And but you're looking down and you're just wondering, you know, are there two bad guys? Are there 200? You know, do they have what kind of weapons do they have? Do they have 51 calibers, which will knock a helicopter out of the sky in a heartbeat? You know, what's going to happen when I hit the ground? Are they going to wait until we're 10 feet off the ground and open up? What's going to happen? And it was usually pretty damn quiet on those things going in. Mm-hmm.
So, did you ever see the enemy?
You know, I never up close, you know.
Right.
Some guy, one lone guy way off in the jungle.
Yeah.
Or as a POW or as a body.
Right.
But in terms of coming face to face, no, I never did. Never fired my weapon in anger. And for an officer, it wasn't that unusual.
Right.
You know, especially for a non-combat arms officer.
Right.
But no, I never fired my weapon.
Do you want to make some comments about the enemy, about the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese? What were your general impressions about these two groups?
Well, just tough little SOBs. Of course, they, like I said before, they just owned the night. I mean, they would basically go anywhere and do anything they wanted at night. Really courageous people.
What makes you say that? What did you hear?
You know, we'd be sitting there on a brigade fire base. We had a whole bunch of infantry troops. We had Sheridan's M551s with flechette rounds. Mm-hmm. We had 105s direct fire. We had M16s. We had Claymores out. We had mortars. We had row and row after row of concertina, with the ground in between just plowed. I mean, a grasshopper couldn't move, you'd see it. And these guys would come right through that outer ring of wire, right across that dirt strip, right up to that inner ring, try to cut through it, and just keep coming. You know, you mentioned Pickett's Charge the other day, and it's just that kind of thing, you know. And except the weaponry is far more lethal. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they're living out in the jungle on a handful of rice. And I mean, literally, you know, mm-hmm. you find a body, and that's what they would have in their food sack. And I'm not saying I love them, but no. Well, you've got to respect them.
Did you respect them then? Or is this kind of looking back at...
It's more kind of looking back than it was at the time. You know, I remember I was walking along the Green Line after a big ground attack one night.
What's the Green Line?
The perimeter, and a bunch of NVA and VC bodies laying inside the wire. I mean, inside the inner. I mentioned that there was a 175 battery, and they were trying to get to that.
Mm-hmm. Is this daytime, nighttime, or nighttime?
Nighttime. The attack was nighttime. I'm walking around in daytime. And I remember thinking, you know, how the hell did they get this far? How did they get clear up here? When you think of the weaponry that was pointed outwards, how in the world did anybody get through that? I mean, flechette rounds, they would pin a man to a tree. And are you familiar with the flechettes? The little steel darts.
I am, but describe it for everyone else.
It's an artillery round or a tank round or a recoilless rifle round, but instead of explosives, it's filled with about 2-inch long steel darts with little fins on them. And when you fire it, they come out of the tube of whatever you're firing, the barrel of whatever mm-hmm. you're firing out of, and they expand mm-hmm. into a broad sweep. Well, here's all these steel darts moving at pretty fast speed. And if there is any living thing in its way, they are not living after it's done. And these darts would just pin them to trees.
What do you think was their motivation? Why would they attack like that?
Yeah, I think it's the same as at Dien Bien Phu. They had a real strong value system, a real strong ideology, a real strong belief in what they were doing. They didn't want to die any more than we did, but they believed in what they were doing so strongly that they were willing to die for it. You know, it was their country, and they really, I think they really saw us as invaders, and well, just like they did the French. And, you know, to some extent they were right, but I mentioned before, I think we went in there for the right reason, but, you know, in terms of how they see us, I'm sure they saw us as, invaders.
What do you think were the enemy's major strengths?
Well, I think the stealth, the ability to move at night, that dedication that I talked about, that motivation to live under terrible conditions and still attack into the face of what must have been almost certain death. I think that was their strong points. Just really, really courageous people. And the weak point, obviously, was they just didn't have the weaponry that we did. If it came to any kind of real fixed battle, I mean, we were gonna win. And militarily, Tet showed that. Like when we would get a ground attack, we'd have a C-130 with a minigun and a 105 howitzer circulating overhead. Well, I mean, they could raise some hell. And they're essentially out of touch, out of reach. They can circle with total impunity.
Puff the magic dragon.
Exactly. And shoot, it's the middle of the night. We can't see them. What do we shoot at?
Of course, now we have infrared. It's all. It's we can see everything at night.
Much
same
different
weapon system.
Much different story now.
Yeah.
We can see them with thermal imaging. We can see each individual now on the ground from several thousand feet. So.
Did you hear scuttlebutt or discussion about the enemy? You know, just you guys hanging out at the base or during your normal work days. Did you all talk about them, or was this something that you kind of concentrated on what you're doing?
In the infantry unit, in 1st to the 5th Cav, we did talk about them.
Because these guys were, as you said, had come out of the field. Some of them that worked for you came out of the field, and they had significant contact.
And the guys who were in the field talked about them a lot too. What are they going to do? How are they going to do it? What is this bunker complex used for? Don't ever try to blow up a well.
Why?
We came through a bunker complex one time.
When was this?
This was when I was with 1st to the 5th, and we were real close to the Cambodian border. I mean, I'm not prepared to say we were over it, but, man, we were on the edge.
What were you doing? I thought you were back in the rear of this.
No, well, this was, and I don't really remember whether this was during that initial period or whether this was later on and I was out there for a day or two.
So you would periodically go out?
Yeah, everybody did. The officers.
Yes.
So everybody did periodically.
Okay.
And I really don't remember when it was, but we came into this deserted bunker complex, and it had been pretty well cleaned out. So, I mean, it had been used in some time. But there was a well in there, and we used to, if we can deprive them of a source of water, then we might do that. Threw a bunch of C4 down there, and it had been lined with wooden poles, maybe 7 or 8 inches in diameter. All it did was blow those all over the place. And the well was still perfectly fine.
Nice hole in the ground, but everything else is blown up.
Everything is fine, yeah. So.
Okay. Interesting lesson.
Blew the bunkers and all that, but there just wasn't much we could do with the wells.
Did you hear or did you sense that the United States soldier, those that you were around during your year there, had respect for the enemy? as far as soldier to soldier, I'm not talking about, you know, whether they were prejudiced or whether they didn't like the Vietnamese people, but really, did the United States soldier that you saw respect the their combatant?
I'm not sure that's the right word. Gosh, that's a hard one to answer. Certainly, we saw them as difficult to defeat. And we never knew whether they were going to walk into one of our ambushes, which they did. Mm-hmm. They were good soldiers, but they weren't Superman. You know, they walked into a few of our ambushes too. I think it was more of just, I can't say respect or disrespect, it was just soldier to soldier. I think, you know, I want to kill him before he kills me, kind of thing. Mm-hmm. It was really the deal. And some of these guys got really, really wound up in that. I mean, staying out in the jungle for month after month.
Yeah, Americans.
Americans. Extending and staying out there. We had one guy, and he had been over there a couple of years at least. He was a staff sergeant, and he liked to walk point. And he was walking down the trail, and everybody wondered when his luck was going to run out. Because he'd been there so long, and everybody knew it was just a matter of time. And he was walking down the trail on patrol one time, and all of a sudden he just pitched right over backwards. Flat on his back in the middle of the trail, just out. And then of course, you heard the report of the gunshot. And everybody ran up and figured, well, that's it. His luck ran out. And he had gotten a spent round. It was just right at the extreme edge of its range, and it had hit the front of his steel helmet, gone completely through, and hit him in the forehead and stopped.
Wow.
Knocked him out cold and put a big bite in his forehead, and that was all. He had a hell of a headache.
Wow.
He was on the bird back to the rear that night.
That was it for him.
That was it for him. And the company commander said, damn right, get on the helicopter.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Somebody was sending him a message, and he heard it. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, probably 50 feet forward, he'd been dead.
What do you think the United States, as far as when you were out in the field, when you would go out there periodically, was the attitude that you saw one of, okay, let's find these guys and make contact, or let's clean up this area and get out of here? I mean, what did you sense? I'm talking morale as well as just an overall attitude.
Really, really individualized kind of thing. I saw some officers and NCOs who just wanted to find them and kill them. I mean, that's what we were there for. We wanted to win the war, and that's how we were going to do it. And they would
search and destroy.
Search and destroy. And they would make every effort to find them and set up ambushes and that kind of thing. At the opposite extreme, I saw guys who would just essentially do anything to hide and not do anything that would precipitate a firefight.
Officers.
The vast majority, of course, fell in the middle, that we're going to go out and do our job, and we're not going to necessarily go spoiling for a fight, but when one comes up, we're certainly going to win it.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the majority.
Mm-hmm.
But you did see some of both extremes. I mentioned the company commander yesterday, who looked like Robert Redford.
Yes.
And he was good. He could find them before they found him, and he could get set up. He had his company so well trained they could get set up, and he surprised them every time. So,
tell me a little bit about the supply missions when you were at the firebase and at El Zidali. And you were in charge of getting ammunition out, getting the letters out, getting food out. Is that correct?
Yep, everything. Everything came, excuse me, from the rear. In that case, Tainan. And everything came out there. Mail, water, was all brought in by helicopter in big 500-gallon rubber bags called blivets. Fuel was brought out in fuel blivets. Mm-hmm. And those were heavy enough to where they were carried by CH-47s normally. And of course, LZ Dolly was on top of a mountain, so a fixed wing could not land. There just was not physically space.
Whereabouts was Dolly, by the way? Just generally?
More north of Saigon than previously.
Okay.
I know that's pretty general, and I'm trying to remember the name of the town that we used to. The Big Red One was there.
Was it more northwest of Tainan Mountain?
More west.
Okay.
More west.
Okay.
Yeah. It was near the Michelin rubber plantations.
Okay. That says it all right.
In fact, our battalion commander's avowed goal in life was to put the Michelin Rubber Company out of business. Colonel Peterson. But anyway, water came out in blivets, fuel came out in blivets, and sea rations, ammunition, both, M16, mortar, M79, every infantry battalion had a 105 battery assigned to it, so artillery ammunition would have to come out mm-hmm. for the 105s.
Mm-hmm.
When we were first setting up the fire base, we'd move in. It was just a hilltop.
So you went out there initially?
Yes.
When it was first formed?
Yes, I was on the first movement into LZ Dolly.
Wow. Well, then, would you mind explaining how you set the fire base? What do you do?
The first thing you do is you start building the TOC, the Tactical Operations Center. And everybody kind of sleeps in tents and kind of makes do while you're doing this. And that's not a true statement. Back up. The first thing you do is set up defensive positions.
Right.
You set up a perimeter. You dig holes. You fill sandbags. You establish security. That's the first thing you do.
Okay.
Then you start working on the Tactical Operations Center, the TOC. And that is basically kind of a bunker. It's usually built out of 12 by 12s and covered with dirt and sandbags and that kind of thing, so it can withstand a pretty good sized mortar or artillery attack.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's your operations center, that's the brain of the battalion.
But how many people are you talking about to go out and set it up?
Well, usually there'd be the battalion headquarters, the forward element of the battalion headquarters, maybe 40 or 50 people,
mm-hmm.
and then there'd be an infantry company to provide security,
okay.
and you would have the artillery battery there with you. And they actually airlifted a bulldozer in, so we could actually dig down into the top of the mountain to put the TOC in. And so you start getting that built up, and usually the battalion commander has a similar structure right next to the TOC where he and the S3 sleep. S3 is the operations officer. He's his right-hand man for combat operations. And so you would set up, you would build the TOC. In this particular one, since it was on top of a mountain, we used to get a lot of, we used to call them tourists coming through, visiting congressmen or people like that. And so he put a battalion commander, Lieutenant Colonel Peterson,
mm-hmm.
put an observation deck on top of the TOC.
Hmm.
And we actually had a visiting congressman come through.
I was going to ask you if you had any tourists.
Yeah, we used to get them all the time.
Really?
Yeah.
Anybody of note that you
Mostly miscellaneous congressmen. And I don't remember any of their names from that time.
How would you all treat them?
Oh, like visiting royalty, yeah. But Colonel Peterson was up there and he had his map set up and he was giving this guy a briefing. And he pointed to the map and then he said, "We're going to put in an arc light, a B-52 strike right there." Pointed at the map and said, "On the ground, it's right there." And he pointed out on the terrain.
Mm-hmm.
And right then the arc light hit.
Wow.
Just as coincidence, that minute the arc light hit.
Wow.
And about 3 square miles of Vietnam went up in dust and splinters.
You were there?
And no, I heard this story.
Okay.
And But everybody was laughing about it. And Carl Peterson looked at that and he went, and blew on his finger. But it was just one of those coincidences that turned out to be pretty funny. Uh-huh. So. But anyway, you get the top belt, and then you start working on bunkers, living and sleeping places, mm-hmm. things like that. Mm-hmm. The S3 was the intel sergeant, and those folks were in a tent, sandbagged up, mm-hmm. and then there were bunkers to sleep in. Mm-hmm. And even though we were actually on top of a mountain, or they were, I wasn't there at the time, actually got a big ground attack. There was one side that was real sheer, and we figured, nobody can come up that. Wrong answer. And they came right up that and got inside the perimeter and started shooting the place up. We hit one KIA and half a dozen WIAs, killed in action and wounded in action from that, and definitely rearranged the security situation on the firebase. Hmm.
Well, that was before you arrived.
Well, I had been there and then gone back.
Okay.
Yeah.
So this whole operation of setting up the firebase, is this, you're talking about 2 or 3 weeks, or is it 2 or 3 days?
Oh, it's, well, to get the talk up and running, it's real quick, usually less than a week.
Okay.
And because that's a pretty concentrated effort. Mm-hmm. And then the improvements and developments go on for many weeks after that. You're constantly improving the perimeter, putting out claymores, more concertina, that mm-hmm. kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. So tell me about the resupply. And
well, everything would come out to the firebase, and actually after a while, of course the first several weeks you just ate sea rations 3 times a day. But after a while we would set up a mess hall, so you actually got usually a hot breakfast and a hot dinner. Mm-hmm. And we would also cook meals for the guys in the jungle. They didn't get one every day, but you know, in rotation. Mm-hmm. And so every company got a log bird, a logistics bird, once a day, at least once a day, whenever it was possible, you know, if there was weather or terrain or something like that. But the goal was once a day.
And as assistant S4, you're the one in charge of this?
Well, a lot of it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And
well, this is why you were there.
Yeah.
And
I lost my train of thought.
The log bird.
So anyway, the company commander out in the field would send in a list, usually to his company XO, saying, okay, I need this, 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 and this. Mm-hmm. And his company staff would go to the S4, get all that stuff, put it all together, and get it ready. And then, of course, there was the routine stuff that always went, like mail. That stuff always went. And so then the log bird come in and land, and we'd load the stuff up or sling it up, excuse me, and give the pilot the coordinates, map coordinates, and the radio frequency and call sign. And he would take off, take it out there, and deliver it, drop it off. And if we could, then we would put Miramites, a hot food, on there, and send that out so the guys could have a hot meal. On occasion, the cooks would take their griddles, their portable field griddles, out, set them up in the jungle, and cook eggs and pancakes and bacon for the guys right there in the middle of the jungle.
Wow. Now, did your firebase there have a set area that you were responsible for? People operating off of that firebase, that's who you resupplied, or just any...
No, units. Just our units.
Just your units that would go off the firebase,
yep.
Do search and destroy 2 or 3 days in the field, a week in the field.
Much longer than that.
Much longer.
Much longer than that, sometimes
okay.
30, 35 days.
Okay.
And, you know, the cab, we would have this real small little battalion firebase, and we'd usually have a company back for security, and they were kind of on their R&R.
Right.
I mean, it certainly wasn't lush and plush, but it was certainly better than walking through the jungle. So they were getting a hot shower and a little rest and that kind of thing, while the other companies were out patrolling in the jungle. After X number of days, they would swap. And the company that had been in the rear would go out in the field. Not the rear, on the firebase. And one of the companies who had been out there for a while would come back to the firebase, and they would provide security, mm-hmm. and at the same time get a little bit of rest.
Okay. were you able to talk to these people and just say, you know, see them at the mess hall, or mm-hmm. or were you pretty isolated?
No, I wasn't isolated at all. You know, one of the things that I had to do was walk the perimeter at night, make sure everybody was awake and all of that. Got one night, and this was back at a previous fire base. I was walking along, and you know, needless to say, these guys are pretty jumpy. And I don't blame them, but I was walking the perimeter, and it was dark. I mean, no moon, no nothing. Mm-hmm. And I'm walking along, checking the bunkers, and all of a sudden I hear the bolt on an M16 come back and go forth. And you talk about a chilling sound. If I'd have been wearing shorts, I'd have had to change them. And, I mean, that is just such a cold sound in the middle of the night like that. And so I let them know right away who I was.
How did you do that?
I said, hey, don't shoot me.
The fancy code words, just don't shoot.
And so they asked me for the password, and I gave it to them and everything. I think they were laughing, but, mm-hmm. you know, they got the LT. Mm-hmm. But
how did you come up with the password?
It was set by the battalion every day.
Oh, every day?
Yeah. Yeah.
What were some of the passwords?
Oh, gosh, I don't remember.
Was it like, you know...
There'd be a sign and a countersign, and when I say they asked me for the password, they would give me, like, ace, spades. That's right. Not a real one because it's too easy, but that's how it worked.
Like thunder, lightning.
Yeah, something like that, yeah. But usually you try to pick two unrelated words, thunder, eggplant.
Right.
You know, so that somebody couldn't just put them together. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of how that worked. But I wasn't thinking about that at the time.
Right, right.
But
I'm going to ask you this, and we can finish up for today. When you're out there on that, you're not in the rear, you're out there on that LZ, out at the firebase, and it's nighttime, you said it's quiet, you know, it's dark. What do you hear? What is that sound? What does Vietnam sound like?
Oh,
I mean, do you hear things from the forest?
Yeah, bug sounds just everywhere. I mean, the bugs were just unbelievable, and they weren't just in the bread, and mm-hmm. they were everywhere. And we were always slathered up with bug juice. Just to kind of try to, especially if you're out walking in the jungle, mm-hmm. On the fire base too. Mm-hmm. Although at Dali it wasn't so bad because we were so high. Mm-hmm. But still, you'd hear them all night long. And every now and then you'd hear something crashing through the jungle. You never did find out what it was. You just knew it was big and you didn't want to meet it.
You knew it wasn't an NVA or BC soldier.
It's too noisy.
Right.
Yeah, if it's crashing through like that, you know, it's an animal of some kind. Mm-hmm. And if we were suspicious or worried, we'd fire a couple flares and, mm-hmm. you know, from the mortars and just take a look. But right. Everybody hated that because it screwed up your night vision.
Right.
But, I don't say everybody hated it, but it certainly did screw up your night vision. And we did have night vision scopes, mm-hmm. but they were not very useful.
To what, like the starlight scope?
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. But they just, I never could see much through them. I mean, the guy would have had to be 10 feet away, and by then I could have seen him with my naked
right.
eye.
So right.
I never did find them very, very useful.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like a jungle.
It sounds like a jungle, it does. And it was pretty creepy, especially if you're there under triple canopy and you can't see the sky at all. And all you can hear are these sounds around there. And I was out on an LP one night, and we were right beside a river. And we had that river at our back, and we were kind of in an arc around it. And we could hear something across the river. And to me, it sounded just like a gun barrel hitting wood. So I was convinced that the entire NVA Army was right across that little river coming to get me. But they didn't. To this day, I don't know what that was. I mean, it might have been BC or NVA. It mm-hmm. might have been an elephant or a tiger. Could have been anything.
What kind of animals did you see up there?
Tigers.
You said, yeah, you told me about the tigers.
Water buffalo, snakes.
What kind of snakes?
I don't know. The kind I ran away from.
pretty often would you see these?
No, they're smarter than we are. Usually they feel us coming and mm-hmm. scurry off into the bush, mm-hmm. but once in a while. And some kind of what looked like a wild hog. I don't know exactly what it was, and it might have been a feral hog for all I know, but looked kind of like a wild hog, a javelina or something like that. Mm-hmm. Okay. But, you know, typically we, you know, pretty distinctive smell because of the diet and all, and they mm-hmm. kind of stayed away from us. So.
What about back in the rear? Did you all tame in, and then Quamoy, did you see snakes? They come up into the...
Never did. Pretty heavily built up area.
Right.
Not only with the U.S. forces, but Tainan was a pretty good sized village itself, mm-hmm. or town itself. And so now it was pretty urbanized by Vietnam standards at that time. Mm-hmm. And so now it didn't really have any significant encounters with wild animals, except when the tiger set the trip flares off.
Right. So. What about rats?
I didn't even think of them, but yeah, when you've got bunkers, you've got rats. We had them. I don't know if you remember the old Willie and Joe cartoon. Mm-hmm. Is make sure you get him with the first shot because they charge when they're wounded. Mm-hmm. And yeah, they were about that big.
Wow.
But we had a vector control officer who was supposed to be responsible for controlling the rat population. But, you know, some poor lieutenant with 5,000 additional duties.
Right.
But.
Okay, why don't we go ahead and stop for
okay.
Thank you, Pat. This is Dr. Richard Barone. I'm continuing my oral history interview with Mr. Pat Curry. Today is July 25th, 2005, and it's approximately 10 minutes until 2 p.m. Central Standard Time, and we're again in the interview room of the Vietnam Archive Oral History Project on the campus of Texas Tech. Pat, before we continue with the story, let's back up a second and talk about we discussed some of your combat experiences and just you know, going out and seeing what was in the field and so you have that under your belt when you went to do your job in the rear. And we talked a little bit after our last session about that. And you had a few things that you wanted to add to that. If you would, go ahead.
Well, I'm concerned. I don't want anyone to think that I'm trying to pretend that I was a frontline combat soldier. I did not do 1/100th of 1% of what the grunts did. And I certainly did not go through 1/1000th of 1% of what they did. And I'm certainly more than willing, obviously, to talk about the little bit that I did do, but I certainly was not a frontline combat soldier, and I think it would be taking something away from those guys if anybody thought I was pretending to be one. I'm proud of what I did, but I certainly did not do what they did.
Okay. Let me follow up on that, if you don't mind. It just came to me, that you know, what are your thoughts about the combat veteran, the American combat veteran in Vietnam? And this is something we can talk about later, upon reflecting on post-Vietnam and what you... how you think about the war and what you feel about the war now, but what prompted you to say that and to have that thought after our last session and to kind of make that disclaimer?
Well, you know, these guys, the Grunts, the 11 Bravos, and the other combat arms guys, the artillery guys, the FOs were right out there with the infantry companies. You know, they did so much, and under such horrendous conditions much of the time. living in the field was not fun. It was wet and it was hot and it was nasty. It was dirty. You know, you got a shower or a bath when you walk through a stream, or about once a month when you got to go to the rear. You know, the constant fear. You know, they went through so much that in no way do I want to try to usurp what they did, to take away from what they did. They ought to be pretty proud of what they did, most of them, and I'm proud of what they did. And I don't want them especially to think that I'm trying to insinuate myself in there as a grunt, as a frontline soldier.
Why do you think that Vietnam veterans, especially the combat arms grouping, why do you think that they, or do you think that they were more traumatized by this war, say, than other wars? Based on what you saw when you were there in Vietnam, and you would interact with them when they would come back to Korea?
I don't think necessarily they were more so than other guys by the combat itself. I think the aftermath probably contribute a lot to it. But I think a lot of people miss the fact that a whole lot of Vietnam vets went over and they did their year, out in the field, out in the jungle, and came back and got on with their life. Obviously not all of them stayed in the Army. In fact, the majority got out, and that's fine. You know, the Army is not a life for everybody. It was for me, but it's not for everybody. But they just, you know, they kind of got on with their life. They went back to school, or they found a job and started a career and a family. Mm-hmm. But I think the World War II guys, you know, if you've seen Band of Brothers or read Tom Brokaw's book, they were pretty traumatized as well. But when they came back, they were welcomed back with open arms, and they were heroes, and they didn't have to kind of skulk around airports, if you will, afraid that somebody's going to accost them like a lot of our Vietnam guys did, and things like that. And I think that made a big difference.
Yeah. Can you describe the interactions that you had with the guys who were out in combat and when they would come back to the rear? How much interaction did you have with these types, and what was it like?
Well, the first 6 months, when I was with 1st and 5th Cav, I had quite a bit, obviously, and most of them were just so happy to be out of the jungle that, they were kind of smiling and wanted to have a couple beers and to kind of relax and get clean, and which was a big thing. I mean, in that kind of environment where it's so hot and sticky and buggy, and just trying to get clean was, mm-hmm. you know, we didn't have the baby wipes and those kinds of things.
Right.
But like I said, most of them were just trying to kind of relax, and they had to some extent kind of an attitude, which I think they certainly deserved. You know, they had been out there doing it while the rest of us were sitting there not. Mm-hmm. And so some of them had kind of an attitude, and I didn't hold that against them. Most of them just, you know, pretty ordinary guys that under pretty extraordinary circumstances, and I think they reacted like pretty ordinary guys would to that kind of thing. Mm-hmm.
Did they ever confront you all, or did you hear of this happening where you were, where, you know, they would say, "Look, you guys back in the rear, you know, what this is really about," or anything like that? And I'm of course referring to the term "rump." You know, did was it that kind of attitude? Did you hear things like this?
Yeah, sure did. And of course, you know, they had the guys out in the jungle. To them, the guys on the battalion firebase were ramps. You know, and to them, the guys in the rear were ramps, and to them, the guys at Long Bend and Benoit were ramps. You know, so it kind of flows downhill.
I've heard that the LRPs, the long range, the reconnaissance patrol guys, would call the regular combat patrol, you know, army, infantry, the ramps.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you're right.
Yeah, that. Yeah, and it was, and you know, I was a ramp. Not as much as some other guys, but the fact is I was not out there walking around in the jungle. You know, and I watched our LRPs one time get extracted on ropes hanging from helicopters. And they just dropped the ropes down, the guys jumped on them, and that's how they rode back, hanging on those ropes. I was impressed. And because that's one of those things I'm not sure I could have done.
Right.
But there was really, most of it was pretty good humored. Not all of it, but I think the majority of it was pretty good humored. Tinged with a little bit of "I did it and you didn't,"
yeah.
Which, as I say, they deserved.
How about from your side, from the rear side, projecting or any kind of attitude toward the infantry when they would come back? Did you all say anything to them, or was there... From your side, what did you hear and see?
Well, you know, we, at least, you know, I mentioned the guy I worked for who was the S4 and the captain, and his attitude was, you know, we need to get them what they need and what they want. And it was kind of talking to me, you know, what didn't you have that you wish you had, and trying to get that out to them, that kind of thing. And we were a little bit insulated by the fact that we were officers. You know, there's that distance there. And so there was a little bit of insulation between us and the enlisted infantry guys that were coming back. They would talk to us as readily as they would each other. One incident of what I just considered outright disrespect, but even as an ordnance officer, you know, the grunts treated me like an officer, and never any incidents. We had a guy on the battalion fire base get drunk one night and decide that he knew better than everybody else, but it was actually a fairly minor incident. And
is that the one that you were referring to?
We thought we were getting incoming small arms fire, and turned out to be a very scared young man who was just seeing things that weren't there. Well, this particular staff sergeant was drunk, sitting in his tent playing cards with his mortar squad, and I went over to route him out, and he decided he just knew a whole lot better than I did, which was probably a true statement, but not relevant. You know, the fact is that whether you're getting it or not, when you think you're getting incoming, he needed to be outside manning his weapon. Mm-hmm. Probably a good thing he wasn't. He did realize he had seriously screwed up and came by later to apologize and tell me I was right, which I knew, and et cetera, et cetera. So.
Do you remember what you said, though? How do you do that? Go into a tent of folks you don't know and say, hey, you know, you need to do this, this, and this.
You need to get outside and man your weapon.
No, as simple as that.
It was as simple as that. And he jumped up and ran outside and started giving me a pretty, pretty hard time. So. And I could have gotten him in a lot of trouble, obviously.
Yeah.
Not so much for what he said to me, but for the fact he was sitting in his tent.
Right.
When this was all going on and everybody was supposed to be out there. But, you know.
He had duty, guard duty, or duty out.
Well, you know, it's the mortar guys. When something happened, they were supposed to be out there manning the mortars. I mean, that was their job.
Right.
And they were just, frankly, too drunk to do it. But I think he learned something from it. I certainly did. So.
I never did
get him in any trouble or anything like that.
Did you think about it before the apology?
I sure did. I thought about it, wondering if I'd go to the XO or the headquarters company commander and say something. I was still kind of thinking about it when he came by, and it was obvious he was pretty worried. Kind of regretted what he had done, and that was good enough for me.
Did you see that the combat arms infantry individuals, that they would drink more or would, you know, party more, or how did they differ in their downtime experiences than, say, you guys would?
Well, everybody, frankly, was drinking so much. I'm not
right.
sure they drank more.
Right.
I think they certainly tried. But I that's a hard question to answer. They had so little downtime that I'd say most of it was, from what I saw, was devoted to trying to get cleaned up and trying to relax a little bit and reading mail, writing letters, you know, the things you typically think of, the old cliches from previous wars. And of course, they were not totally up, excuse me, on vacation, if you can use that word. They had perimeter duty at night,
right,
and on a reduced scale during the day as well, and those kinds of things. I'm not sure I'm answering your question, but I'm not sure what the answer is.
Well, that's an answer right there in and of itself. Let's go back for a moment. You had asked that you wanted to make some more comments about an individual that touched your life while in Vietnam, and somebody that you remember well from that time period, and that's Charles Chandler, Chick Chandler.
Yeah, and I did. I kind of got off track on that, and as I mentioned, in a perfect world, his son, that he never got to see, would see this one day, and know that that he was, his dad was well thought of, not just by me, but by pretty much everybody. Mm-hmm. He had been a captain for about 5 minutes when the battalion commander made him a company commander, which tells you that he was well thought of. And Chick was just one of those unusual guys. He just was very charismatic, outgoing without being boisterous and loud about it. Very bright guy, very smart guy, and we got to be, at least from my perspective, pretty good friends, and got to know each other a little bit. And in fact, after he got killed, Diane and I had been discussing whether to bring Lynn, our oldest daughter, who I had not seen, bring her on R&R to Hawaii,
right?
And because Chick had not. And, of course, after he got killed, that really made the decision for us. And Diane, of course, brought Lynn, and I got to see her when she was 4 months old, and just loved every second of it and was really glad that we had made the right decision. And I went back much more comfortable. But anyway, Chick deserves to be remembered just for being the kind of guy he was and the kind of leader he was. And, you know, he was my friend, and, mm-hmm. and it was real... It was a real loss, personally and professionally, both. And I'm sure, obviously, his family was pretty devastated. I know his wife wrote me, she was pretty, as you might expect, pretty well trash. And I mean that in a psychological sense. She was just destroyed. So I had some friends who had notification duty, where they would have to go to houses and knock on the door. And, you know, that's one job I'm not sure I might have resigned before I took that job.
When you said he was a good leader, what did you see in him that made him a good leader?
You know, he could talk to NCOs and he could talk to soldiers, and they would pretty willingly do what he wanted done. It wasn't a matter of, well, the captain said or the lieutenant said I have to do it, so I'm going to do it. It was, they just went out to do it. You know, kind of that ideal of leadership where they did it because they wanted to. And I wanted to do it for him. And it's pretty rare quality. Throughout my 25 years of service, of Army, it was a pretty rare quality. And it just kind of seemed to come effortlessly, just naturally to him. And I mentioned he's a pretty charismatic guy. And he could talk to him in a pretty familiar way, but that distance and that sense of discipline was always there. They never stepped over that line like they did with some of the other officers who thought that, you know, well, we're going to be buddies, and which is not a good approach. But he was able to keep that relationship, if you will, going, but still maintain that sense of discipline and sense of, I'm the officer, you know, you're going to have to do what I say.
Yes. I imagine that's difficult to do.
It's extraordinarily difficult to do, and it's something I think most officers struggle with, those that are fortunate enough to be with troops the majority of their career, as opposed to staff kind of jobs. I think it's something that those kind of guys struggle with most of their career. And Chick never struggled with it. I mean, it was just there. Just seemingly effortless.
Yeah, he commanded respect just by being him.
He did, yeah. Well, and that's a good way to put it. That's a good way to put it. He did. And I had a lot of respect for him. Of course, we, you know, brother officers, we were friends as well. Yeah. But I just had an immense amount of respect for him.
What do you remember him looking like?
Oh, gosh.
That might be hard after all this time.
Well, you know, it's funny. I still have a mental picture of him. I won't swear how accurate it is, mm-hmm. but he was a few inches shorter than I am. And
how tall are you?
I'm 6'3". Okay. He's probably, gosh, 5'11". Okay. Maybe somewhere right around there, okay. 6 foot. A little stockier. At that time, unlike now, I was kind of skinny, but... A little bit stockier, had kind of a little round, not a little, but a round face, and kind of like brown hair. And, you know, just kind of an ordinary looking guy.
Yeah. Was he, you know, clean shaven, or did he have any kind of facial hair?
No, he was
himself up.
Yeah, he did. He did. He kept himself up. He always looked good. Always looked like an officer should. And clean shaven, and kept his hair trimmed, and just kind of maintained a high standard.
Right.
And always. He had very high standards for himself and others, and he maintained those standards himself, and he expected other people to too.
When you said, when you talk about two of you as friends, tell me what you all would do together. I mean, I guess you'd work together.
Well, we worked together. We would play cards in the evening.
What kind of games? What kind of card
games? Oh, poker, blackjack. I'm not much of a gambler, but I played in Vietnam, and I don't really call it gambling because gambling implies there's some possibility of a return, which was apparently not much of a possibility for me. But anyway, if they had a movie or a USO show, we'd go to those together, sit around and talk, have breakfast and have a cup of coffee. And that kind of thing.
Do you remember what you were talking about?
I talked about family a lot. Talked about our families a lot. And of course, we both had babies we had not seen. So that was a major topic. And about our wives and what we did in the States and where we went to school and of course about the war and what was going on. And neither one of us were particularly political. So we didn't really get into that a whole lot, but the things we did during the war and that kind of stuff.
Do you remember anything about him personally? Like, was he a St. Louis Cardinals fan? Or just, do you remember something he would bring up or talk about?
Yeah.
Some people you can say, oh yeah, that guy's a Red Sox fan.
Yeah. No, I really don't.
Okay.
I really don't. I know he was a fan of his wife and his son, but now it's just been too many years, I'm afraid.
What about, do you remember, and this might be difficult to first remember and second to talk about, but do you remember what he said about what he wanted to do with his son or with his family when he got back? Did he talk about future plans? I often hear veterans of the war, no matter where they serve, talk about what they were going to do after the war. Do you remember any of that discussion?
Other than just spending a lot of time with his family, I really don't. But that stands out. And we were both that way, but I remember him talking about that, how he wanted to see his son grow up and get to know his wife again. And I got the feeling they had a pretty close relationship, and that the miles didn't necessarily, 10,000 miles didn't necessarily make that relationship less close and less intimate between them. He just talked about her like she was 10 minutes away, I had that mental mindset, and he was really focused that way, but gosh, it's been almost 40 years, and I just really, trying to remember is pretty difficult. I'm surprised, but I have a pretty clear mental image. But obviously the things I remember are kind of the high points.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Well, he certainly seemed to make an impression on you.
He really did. I mean, like I said, it's been almost 40 years, and I still remember him. And every time I go to the wall or the wall comes here, I look him up. And I have not made a rubbing of his name, although I've thought about it. I just haven't. And I don't know why, but it just somehow doesn't seem... I don't know, respectful, I guess, but yeah, made a big impression on me. He's one of those people in my life that did make a big positive impression on me.
When you see his name on the wall, what do you think about him?
I think about just what a damn shame. Not a waste. He was doing what he wanted to do. It was not a waste. But it's just a damn shame. He could have done things and he should have had time to get to know his family and his son. And that's what I think about. It's just, but I never think it's a waste. Not ever.
Okay. Is there anything else that you do want to talk about with him concerning him before we move on?
just that, and I think I mentioned it before, but one of the regrets in my life is I didn't stay in touch with this man. I should have done that. It was kind of funny that they kind of really actively discouraged you, they being the command, actively discouraged you from contacting the families of the soldiers killed in action. Well, they were afraid, and I think rightfully so, afraid's the wrong word, concerned, that the family member would get a letter from some friend saying, you know, gee, I'm really sorry, before the Army had had time to notify them, to see. And I think that's a legitimate concern. And I certainly waited some time before I wrote to Mrs. Chandler and to express my feelings and tell her how sorry I was. But, you know, the other guys, the other officers were saying, you know, you got to be real careful doing that.
And you wrote her from Vietnam?
I wrote her from Vietnam, yeah. And I should have gone and looked her up when I got back.
Is that the only contact you had?
That was the only contact I had. I wrote her and told her how I felt and how sorry I was and how much I knew that he loved her. And how sorry he would be not to get to know his son. She wrote me back, probably the letter I remember most of my whole life. How glad she was to get my letter, and she's going to save it for her son. And she wanted me to stay in touch and do it. I feel bad to this day. And there's just no excuse for it. I just screwed up.
Well, tell me about what prompted you to write her. I guess obviously you wanted to tell her about her husband because you knew him well. But when did you decide you wanted to do that, and why did you do it?
I decided just almost immediately. I wanted her to know what she already knew, obviously, was that her husband was really a good guy. And I wanted her to know that other people felt that way. And that that he had made an impact. And I just told her about some of the things we did together. I mentioned that court-martial that we had worked on together, and I mentioned that. And I told her about how much he talked about her and his son and that kind of thing. And I guess it just felt right. You know, it's the only time I ever did it. But for him, it just felt right. And I can't sit here and tell you why he made such a big impact on me. Certainly something I thought about, but I don't know. But I know that he did. For me to remember him 40 years later, I mean, it speaks for itself, and I think it speaks for him. And I would bet you my house and my car that I'm not the only guy that remembers him. I mean, he was too well thought of and too well respected. And I just know I'm not the only guy that remembers him. So.
Well, he's living in your memory for sure.
He is that, and I have taken my wife and my daughters to the wall to show them his name, and only two young ladies that I work with that are kind of special. I've taken them out there, and they're the only ones I've done that with. One day I'll take my grandson out there.
Mm-hmm. He can also listen to this interview someday and talk about it. Because he'll remember if you do that, your grandson will remember. Yeah, I'm taking him to the wall and showing him Chick's name.
And I'm going to do that. Yeah. A couple more years before he's old enough to understand. He's only 7 now. Sure. But when he gets up a little older, then it'll be time.
Okay. Well, moving on as far as what you did there. I wonder if we could, before we continue, I'm going to take a break.
Okay.
Okay, Pat, continuing. You were on the side of the supply that not a lot of people know about. You were on the end that, you weren't on the receiving end. You were on the end that made sure that the guys got what they needed in the field. You saw what they needed and what they needed most, what they needed least. Could you speak to that? What you saw, that, you know, what was the thing that you needed, you had to get there, And what were the things, maybe the extraneous things, that the request came that, hey, I need to get, you know, some more socks, or what kind of things like that?
Priority number one was bullets. I mean, no question, hands down. And the ammunition resupply request was what was processed first. Unless one of the units had been in a big firefight, normally didn't have to move a lot of ammunition, class 5 we called it. But, you know, you might have to send trip flares if some flares got sent off. If they were carrying mortars, illumination rounds for mortars, claymore mines, if some of those had been set off, that kind of thing.
So it was the weapons, the pieces of war was the first priority?
First priority.
Okay.
Repair parts for weapons or new weapons if something needed to be sent to the rear to be repaired. You know, a guy had to have an M16. He sent a new weapon out, something like that. On the evening log bird, if they were going to set up and the company commander wanted it, we might send out recoilless rifles, we might send out mortars. Mm-hmm. If they had not been carrying them. And our units were so light, a lot of times they did not carry the heavier weapons, but we could send them out at night, so they would set up a perimeter. The recoilless rifles with the flechette rounds, the steel darts, were used in ambushes because you could put them adjacent or on a trail. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the recoilless rifles have that huge back blast. And so no matter which direction they came from on the trail, you had them.
Right.
If they came from the front, the flechette round, if they came from the rear, set the round off anyway, mm-hmm. and the back blast would certainly ruin their evening.
Mm-hmm.
And that was first. And second was food. Tried to get hot food out when we could. I had a mess hall in the battalion fire base. Tried to get, especially in the evening, get hot food out in Marmite cans. Occasionally.
I remember you talked about the cooks going out one time.
Several times, yeah. The cooks would go out and set up their field grills and cook the guys a hot breakfast right there in the field. Eggs and pancakes to order and bacon and... I always thought kind of a pretty good thing to do for the guys, because they ate a lot of sea rations, and those get old in a hurry. Oh, it takes about 15 minutes for sea rations to get old. Ham and limas. Although we had guys that loved them, I never understood myself. But anyway... to this day, I cannot look a lima bean in the face. But
really?
Oh, I hate lima beans. But food would be the second. Resupply of sea rations to make sure that they had kind of a minimum load of sea rations. Mm-hmm. In case, you know, if weather set in, we couldn't get a bird out there, they had something to eat. Mm-hmm. So they usually carried a couple days' worth of sea rations around. A high priority when we could was mail. We would try to, when we could, take the nylon mail bags and put some ice and some beer in there, 2 beers a guy, mm-hmm. and send those out so that they could maybe have no more than 2. The NCOs had to enforce, you know, if you hit some guy who didn't drink,
right.
Or a couple guys, one guy didn't get 6 beers,
right.
Because then he was useless the rest of the night. Plus he was staggering out around all night trying to find a place to pee.
Mm-hmm.
And then the kind of the last priority was the resupply that the company commander wanted. He would send in or radio in a list to his company rear, who their supply sergeant would work with the S4 to get it put together, and that might be, you know, socks or, uniforms. We would periodically just take a bunch of washed uniforms, and they were just kind of general issue uniforms. They didn't have name tag on them because they didn't belong to any one guy. Mm-hmm. Didn't have a name tag, didn't have a unit patch, this kind of thing. Mm-hmm. They would just go to a laundry in the rear and get washed en masse, and then kind of get sorted roughly by size, and we'd send those out so the guys could swap their dirty uniforms for at least for a clean one. And get some clean clothes, didn't have often enough, but right. But it was it was something.
Right. What were some of the more unusual requests from the field? Do you remember anything
like
that?
Oh gosh, they were really kind of routine, kind of standard. Radio batteries, I probably should have mentioned because that was a big one. The radios ran 24/7, and you certainly wanted them to run 24/7, and. I mean, that was your contact with reinforcements, with artillery support, with TAC air, with gunship support. So we shipped a lot of radio batteries, but, most of them were pretty routine kinds of things.
Water?
Yes.
Include that with the food, I guess?
Include that with the food, yeah.
How much water did you... Do you estimate that they would go through?
Oh, gosh. A couple of canteens a day, a man. A lot of the guys carried three canteens. Everybody carried at least two. But a lot of guys carried three. Mm-hmm. Try to send a lot of Tabasco sauce. Put on the sea rations. Add at least some kind of flavor to them. One of the biggest jokes was the Playboy Sea Ration Cookbook. Obviously, I'm not the first one to mention that.
I've heard that before. What's your comment on that?
Well, it was a fine cookbook for sea rations if you had an entire grocery store full of spices behind you. But, I mean, the availability of the stuff they wanted you to put on your sea rations was ridiculous.
Yeah.
I mean, you didn't have cayenne pepper in the field. And guys would send for that and be all anxious to get it and everything, and it would invariably wind up being used for other purposes.
Mm-hmm.
And that was just a joke. Mm-hmm. But did have some recipes. If you took the canned bread and some other stuff, you could make kind of a pizza and anything for a little variety.
Sure.
In the MREs that we had later. In my career, were certainly tasted better, but they got old just as fast.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What about you mentioned the weather that would ground the logbooks? Mm-hmm. What kind of weather would keep a helicopter from going off?
You know, the helicopter pilots were just an interesting breed. I mean, those were the gutsiest SOBs around. God, the things they did. And I have to tell you about a guy, Billy May, that I went to the advanced course with. He was as nuts as the rest of them, but it took pretty bad weather to ground the slick pilots. The UH-1 and Huey, it took pretty bad weather to ground them. I mean, I saw them go out in weather that was just unbelievable, wind and rain and everything else. They might not be able to man, but they'd at least get close enough to kick it out the door for the guys to get it. The best ones were the medevac pilots. Billy May was a medevac pilot.
Okay. Tell me about the Dustal pilots. What did you see?
Jesus, I just can't even comprehend doing what they did. I mean, they had two door gunners, which was a lot like throwing rocks, and they would go into some place that was very hot. And Billy May told me one time he went in, it was real tight, he had to come right straight down. And he saw chips coming off a tree, and he thought his main rotor blade was hitting it. He looked, his main rotor blade was clearing by 5 feet. It was machine gun fire. And, of course, he used to love to shoot down a helicopter. So they just went into places and got out of places that was just truly amazing. I mean, the slick was just an amazing piece of equipment. And the guys that flew them were just phenomenal guys. So we used to kid the pilots about being cab drivers and all that, but they were just, I mean, those were some brave guys.
Yeah. What kind of weather was bad weather that would ground?
A lot of times, if the visibility was real limited, because they had to identify you know, the guys on the ground would throw smoke, and they had to be able to see that smoke and identify it, and then enough visibility for somebody to guide them in to a place big enough to land.
Right.
So that was a problem. If the weather was so bad, rain, especially if it was driven by wind, so you couldn't see, fog.
Mm-hmm.
Not weather related, but triple canopy jungle was needless to say a challenge.
Mm-hmm.
But the slick had a hook on the bottom, and you could kind of lower that down through. And in fact, you could bring people back up. They even had some cages that you could take wounded out without getting them all beat up in the canopy.
Mm-hmm.
Just extract them right through that three layers of triple canopy jungle. So that wasn't as much of a problem, except that they were stationary for a long time.
Right.
You know, I mean, they were just hovering there. But but I mean, we couldn't see them, and a lot of times the bad guys couldn't either. But yeah, the fog, blowing rain, real heavy rain, and I mean, it would rain so hard. You couldn't see 20 feet. It was coming down that hard, and that was miserable.
How often would it rain?
Well, in the monsoon season, it would rain essentially daily.
How do you deal with that? Just hot, wet, and all the time?
Well, and then you have to decide if you're going to get under your poncho. Because if it's 100 degrees and 100% humidity outside the poncho, inside this rubber envelope, you know, it's 120 degrees and 110% humidity. And so, what degree of suffering were you willing to take? And when I talked about the conditions that the grunts lived under, that's one of the things I was referring to is, you know, they'd go days at a time and never be dry.
Yeah. And you guys can get dry eventually.
Sure, we could always get dry. You know, we'd go in our hooch and change clothes and dry off and, you know, we were going to get a hot meal that evening, and you know, we weren't going to the old club afterwards. But we certainly had a lot better than those poor guys.
While we're on the subject, tell me about Vietnam physically. What did it look like to you? You mentioned triple canopy jungle. So what do you remember about Vietnam? What do you see?
Well, you know, it really depends on where you were. Mm-hmm. We came in at I Corps, and I was surprised how cold it got at night. We used to have to really kind of roll up. And now, of course, it got pretty warm during the day, but it was chilly at night.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of it was the humidity. But once we get down to Three Quarter, it was, you know, it's just like Robin Williams in the movie. It's hot,
mm-hmm.
and hot and wet. And up in I Corps, we saw our mountains. It was pretty hilly, pretty mountainous terrain,
mm-hmm.
Hence the Oshawa Valley. And but when we got down to Three Corps around Tainan, imagine a pool table with a mound in the middle, and that's what it looked like. We had Nui Ba Dinh Mountain, the Black Virgin Mountain, I think we talked about that, right in the middle of this perfectly flat plain, and the infantry officers and the artillery guys were telling me what was really difficult to navigate, land navigation. There was just, I mean, there were no landmarks. You know, you take a look at your map and the grid lines are 2 feet apart on the map,
right.
You know, because it's so flat.
Right.
And there's just very difficult to navigate. A lot of times they would have the artillery shoot a smoke round to a known coordinate. And that would at least give them an idea of where they were.
Okay.
And but then as you got over a little northwest of there, it started getting a little more hilly again. Not much, but a little bit. The jungle would be so thick at times. I mentioned the triple canopy. It would be so thick at times that it just kind of blocked out the daylight. You know, it was always kind of a twilight on the jungle floor. Obviously, where we had fire bases set up, I mean, we had just, I mean, there was nothing there more than 6 inches tall that wasn't man-made.
Mm-hmm.
But in the jungle, it got dim. And there were times where it was so overgrown and down so low that you just had to crawl on hands and knees. to get through it. Mm-hmm. And if you cut through it, it would just take you 9 years. And there were trails. I was amazed at the number of trails cut through there. Some of them people, some of them animal trails. And obviously, if you get around a little village, you got a lot more trails. Mm-hmm. But and that's kind of what it was like. The rubber plantations were just what you might expect, just evenly spaced trees as far as you can see, rubber trees as far as you can see. A lot of them shredded by artillery and et cetera. So.
How much of a role do you think geography played in the Vietnam War? I mean, obviously, it plays a significant role, yeah. But what it just kind of reflecting on that, what you just said?
Gosh. Well, without the helicopter, we certainly would not have landed. Lasted, 20% of what we did. That's what made us mobile. The other guys could move. I guess they weren't as used to being motorized or mechanized as we were, and they could just move enormous amounts of material. Through the jungle. Mm-hmm. Some of the bunker complexes and full hospitals with well stocked with medical supplies, tons of ammunition. You just don't see how they carried all that in by hand. But of course, that's what the French said after 1954. How'd they do that? Of course, we were pretty well tied to the roads and the helicopters much of the time. But gosh, that's really a hard question to answer. I'm not really a tactics guy. I'm not sure how to answer that.
Well, you saw it, and you on the resupply problem sometimes because of the weather and the terrain. Geography would affect the weather, or they would intermingle and make it impossible. When I ask you about Vietnam, what's the first kind of thing you see? Do you see a rice paddy? Do you see your base there at Tainan?
No, I see a jungle, real green, real wet, real damp. And I hadn't even thought about the rice paddies. I didn't spend that much time. I flew over them a lot, but didn't spend much time in them really. Most of my time either. On a battalion fire base kind of thing, or on a brigade fire base, was in heavy jungle.
Okay. Going back to the resupply, how often would you all go out, or would you just make sure coppers were out there going to do it? Was it as often as possible, or often as needed, or twice a day?
Tried for twice a day, morning and evening. Kind of an operational minimum was once a day. An evening log burn was what we tried for sure to do, mm-hmm. if at all possible. But we did try for twice a day if we could.
Okay. Did you all have enough of the supplies that the men needed in the field? Could you get what you needed to take out to them?
Absolutely.
So there was never a problem?
There was never a problem. I don't remember anything that we were short of.
Okay.
Sometimes it was interesting moving it from point A to point B. I mentioned class 5 ammunition. Mm-hmm. Well, as an air cab unit, we were pretty light and had pretty light weapons. But we had a squadron of the 11th Armored Cavalry Regiment. Actually, I guess it was a troop. 11th ACR, which was armored cab, attached to us. And part of that was for logistical support. And they used a lot of 50 caliber ammunition. A box of 50 cal ammunition weighs 80 pounds. And they used a lot of it. They would set up a perimeter at night with their tracks, and the first thing they did would be fire all their 50 caliber machines out all the way around. Just kind of level the jungle. And that uses a lot of bullets. And I'll never forget one time we were back at Tay Ninh in 11th, this troop called a tactical emergency, a TACI airlift for 50 cal ammunition. We had officers, we had NCOs, we had enlisted, we had everybody down there taking 50 caliber ammunition off the back of trucks, one box at a time, and loading it on
on CH-47s to get it out to them. They thought they were going to get a ground attack, mm-hmm. just imminently, mm-hmm. and it turned out not to happen, but that was more 50 caliber ammunition we'd ever moved. We didn't even have 50 caliber, but I mean, we had them by MT-1A, but by two per battalion or something like that. So,
tell me about being out there at the LZ Dali, and this has still been your first 6 months. Mm-hmm. About casualties coming in, and how the dust balls would go out and get them and bring them back. Would you see them return with the casualties?
Sometimes. It depended on a couple of variables. One was the conditions. A lot of times, if they could, medevac would pick them up and take them right to a field hospital in the rear. And I mean, the medical support in that context was really good. And if it was humanly possible, the medevac pilots were going to get in there and get them out. If they weren't too bad, and there were more guys, you know, maybe it's a relatively minor wound that the battalion surgeon or a medic could handle, stabilize them, and there were other guys waiting, they would bring them to the fire base, and they would the battalion surgeon, who was a doctor, and the medics would treat them until we got another bird in to take them back to the rear. So everybody went to the rear that was wounded.
Right.
And some of them came back fairly quickly if it was real minor. Mm-hmm. But yeah, sometimes we'd see them, and the KIAs came through. One of my vivid memories was when we were on a fire base, a battalion fire base, and it was not Dali. It was one of them before that. Mm-hmm. And one of our companies had been in a firefight. Had a KIA, and I walked out, and I don't remember what I was doing, but I walked out the perimeter, and out there on the LZ was a stretcher, and used to take and wrap a poncho, put them on a stretcher, wrap a poncho around them real tight, mm-hmm. and laying out there on the LZ was a stretcher with this poncho about it, around it, and this guy still had his boots on and everything. An old first sergeant out there, just kneeling down by him, just holding his head and waiting for the bird to come in and take the guy out. And first sergeant obviously wasn't going to let him wait there by himself. And I mean, that just, and the light was real weird, and it was kind of stormy off in the distance, and the sunlight was real weird, and just that image through the concertina of that first sergeant laying there, or sitting there, kneeling there with that guy, is just so vivid. It's like it was yesterday.
The guy in the stretcher, he was dead?
Yes, yeah, he was KIA. Okay. Killed in action. Sure. And, he'd been killed in that firefight, and they brought him back to the fire base, mm-hmm. waiting on another bird to come get him and take him back to the rear.
Did you get used to that?
No, nobody ever got used to it. You know, that's an easy one to answer. You never got used to that. We had a lieutenant who came in country, an infantry lieutenant. He'd gone through the rotation like we all did, and made him a platoon leader. And he had been after a week. And nobody could understand why he did it, but when they walked into an ambush, they had a Chinese claymore, which was kind of a round mine, and he just stood up and charged it, and bullets flying all over the place, and the story I was told was he just stood up and charged it. We got about 3 feet away from it, and they blew it, and I mean, he never had a chance to shred it, and nobody ever understood. I mean, nobody could figure out what was going through his mind, you know. Of course, not from what the guys told me was you didn't think a lot. You know, you just reacted, and if you were trained right, you reacted properly. But he didn't make it a week. But then I had to go through his wallet and make sure there was nothing in there you didn't want his folks to see.
You had to go through
his wallet. Yeah, his first sergeant and I, not first sergeant, company XO. XO and I went through that just to make sure, but no, you never got it. never got used to it.
Right.
It was always just a, you know, just a twist. So even if you didn't know the guy, you know, it was just a twist in your gut that, you know, somebody had been killed.
Did you get a bag of these personal effects, or you would take it off the person, someone would bring it in?
No, somebody would bring it in. And, you know, we try to take care of the families. We didn't want them to, you know, guys when they're off by themselves at world do things that maybe families shouldn't know about. Definitely don't need to know about.
What if the family members tried to find out exactly what happened?
That was
how hard was that to find?
That was, it was reasonably difficult, but a lot of times the company commander would write a letter and kind of give them some general details and that kind of thing. And it went up from there. The battalion commander would try to deal with it.
I'm going to take a break just for sure. Okay, Pat. I'd like to know, when you transitioned to the 27th Maintenance Battalion, tell me about that transition, how that came about, and how much you knew about where you'd be going, what you'd be doing. I remember you talked a little bit about that last time you touched on it, but tell me about that transition.
Well, I mentioned the Combat Arms Replacement Program. It sent combat service support officers to infantry units and for a six-month period. And as I was getting close to 6 months, I called the Division G1, who was the personnel officer, and said, you know, my time's coming up and my 6 months, and I'd like to go to the maintenance battalion and, you know, work in my field. Mm-hmm. And they said, okay, you know, you did your time, we'll move you. And so time came around, and I got orders and got reassigned. And I happened to be at, I want to say 10 men at the time. I wouldn't swear to that, but anyway, I got orders and went out and got on an airplane and flew to the battalion rear for the 27th Maintenance Battalion, which happened to be in Benoit. Mm-hmm. And they interviewed me, battalion commander and the XO, et cetera, interviewed me. And apparently I didn't do well. They sent me to, they called it B Detachment, but I called it B Company. B Company, the 27th Maintenance Battalion, and which was at Quan Hoi. And I was the XO, Company XO, and the shop officer. And worked for a real good guy named Jack Yancher, Captain Yancher. By this time, I was first lieutenant with, I guess, 3 or 4 months in grade. Mm-hmm. And it turned out to be a real life-changing event for me in a couple of different ways. After we were more or less, not permanently, but semi-permanently at Quan Hoi, was a brigade fire base of the 1st Cav. Our detachment provided maintenance support to 1st Cav units in that general area. Mm-hmm. Generally speaking, a weapon or a piece of equipment would come in out of the field, and we would repair it and give it back to them. If it was not repairable, we would wash it out of the system and they would requisition a new one. Mm-hmm. And this is the stuff that came from Ford was all smaller items. The bigger items, the trucks, those kinds of things, trailers. One of the most important pieces of equipment you had was your water buffalo, water trailer. That's how you moved water to the airfield to move it forward. We also were supply for some items, so if they needed repair parts or something along those lines, they could requisition it to our supply element. We didn't do food, we didn't do ammunition, but we did most of the other stuff.
And this is what you were specifically trained to do?
This is what I was specifically trained to do, was this job. And I had been a shop officer in the 2nd Armored Division in the States.
Right. And you felt comfortable doing that. And I remember you saying that you felt good. Well, you felt good about what you had done, and your training had paid off.
It had.
Now, how much difference was there between stateside shop supervisory experiences versus in the field, war?
It was a lot of difference. You know, the mix of items that we received was a lot different, obviously, from an armor division to an air mobile division.
Yes.
You know, we didn't get tracks and those kinds of things in because we didn't have them. We would get a deuce and a half every now and then. A lot of generators, a lot of weapons. Probably the most critical thing that we worked on was sights for artillery. And we had a real problem with them because the seals would fail, and in the humidity they would fog.
Mm-hmm.
And so we'd have to purge them with nitrogen and then put new seals in so that they would last for a while. And one of my real war stories had to do with an artillery site. But anyway, that's the troops would didn't require as much direct first line supervision.
Meaning the folks who worked under you,
yes,
did the day to day repairs.
Yes, okay. Yeah, and had an old first sergeant Jacob, who could fix anything. As the cliche goes, if he couldn't fix it, it wasn't broken. And great big guy.
Yeah.
Never make it in today's army.
How old was he, do you think?
Oh, gosh, probably in his 40s.
And you were what, 20?
24.
And you were his supervisor.
I was his supervisor.
His
yeah.
junior. Well, how did he take to that? Was he, yeah, I guess he was used to it.
He was used to it. He was a professional NCO, and you know, and he would tell me what he thought. And he had the best interest of the company at heart.
He was there when you arrived?
He was there when I arrived.
Yes.
And I came in as the XO and shop officer, which is the same position. And after a couple of months, much to my surprise, Lieutenant Commander Colonel Hawk made me company commander.
Why do you say much to your surprise?
Well, here I was with the lieutenant, as a lieutenant with 3 or 4 months in grade. Captains were dying for command time. Not many of them were that anxious to get to Cornwall, which was a pretty miserable place. But of course, anybody who was planning on staying in the Army wanted to command. You know, as an officer, that's what you do.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was, and there were several captains back at battalion headquarters that had not commanded. And I was pretty surprised when he asked me if I wanted it. And I said, yes, sir, you bet. He said, well, we'll try you out 30 days, 60 days. Anyway, we'll try you out for X number of days.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of that period, we'll make a decision. And I thought, fair enough. You know, I'll make it or not on my own.
Mm-hmm.
Colonel Hawk's one of the finest men I ever knew. I retired as a brigadier general. His choice. He could certainly have gone on, in my mind, to be at least the desk hog of the Army, which is a 3-star, and possibly higher than that. He was just a great guy and a really good leader, another one of those real charismatic leaders.
Mm-hmm. When you say charismatic leader, what do you mean exactly?
I mean a guy that it just comes naturally to, that you follow because he's a leader, he knows it, you know it, and you know, you have great confidence that the things he's asking you to do are the right things to do, and the things that need to be done, and you need to do them well.
Okay.
You know, just kind of that natural leadership. And he was that way, and very relaxed and comfortable in that role. And we saw quite a bit of him when we got, him and his wife, Mickey, when we got back to the States. And And I don't want to imply that he was an easy guy. I'll never forget one time, completely unannounced, he walks into my orderly room. Well, I had no idea he was even coming. And I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "Come on, Lieutenant. I'm going to talk. You're going to listen." And I said, "Yes, sir." And that's the way it went. Mm-hmm. And but he was giving me some very good guidance on some things that I just didn't have the experience to know.
Right.
But he was just a great guy and a good guy to work for. And he had a lot of confidence in me, which helped me. Mm-hmm. So anyway, he made me the company commander, and at the end of whatever that period was, he was pretty happy with what I was doing, and wrote me probably the best efficiency report I've ever gotten in my life. It was so good that the DISCOM commander, the Division Support Command commander, who was his boss, popped into my company area unannounced to see if I was really that damn good. But the OER went through, and I was amazed. I felt good about what I was doing. I felt like I was doing a good job. Mm-hmm. After that initial spate of Article 15s when I was trying to get everybody's attention.
Right.
But I mentioned I didn't have a degree. And I had applied for the undergraduate degree commissioning program, the college program. The undergraduate degree completion program is what it was called, and been turned down. And
what was the reason to you?
Yeah, I did that first OER I got in Vietnam, I mentioned before, it was a stinker, and they just figured I had no future in the Army. Then Joe Davis gave me a good one, covered that one up, and the XO, Battalion XO took good care of me. Mm-hmm. Well, then I got there, and I got a good OER as XO of the company, and then this one that Colonel Hawk wrote, mm-hmm. General Hawk, and wrote, and when that hit DA, they called me and said, where would you like to go to college and when? It was that good. It was that good. I was stunned. I wish I had been that good.
Why do you say that? Maybe you were that good.
Maybe I was. I certainly had a very successful company.
It sounds like this colonel would not have done that if he couldn't have backed up his work.
So you got that right. I'm extremely confident of that.
Right. So obviously you were good. Can you tell me?
I was lucky. I was very lucky. I had a really good first sergeant. I had some really good soldiers, and it was a different Army. I mean, the guys today are top notch. You just can't beat them. But we had a lot of draftees. In my unit, we didn't have so many draftees as we did guys who had enlisted to pick a specific MOS, a specific military job. Mm-hmm. And so we had quite a few of those, although I had one guy, Pops Strangio. Pops was from Boston, had a good machine shop business in Boston, his own business and family. And he was the old man of the company, non-NCO, old man of the company. He was probably 26 or 27. Mm-hmm. And that's why we called him Pops.
Right, right.
Even I, as the company commander, called him Pops. And he used to look at me, and here I was several years, and he said, he'd shake his head, "The old man." He'd shake his head, "You'd call company commander the old man."
Right.
That came from my father's day when company commanders were old men. Mm-hmm. But anyway, he'd just shake his head. But once I got their attention and they understood me, we just had an exceptional company. And I had everybody has their 10%, and I had mine. But I was fortunate. I had 10% where other guys had 20 or 30 or 40%. One story that Strangio told me about the first sergeant, about Jaco, was Strangio had been working on this generator, and it was a radio generator. It was a generator to run the radios in a command post, so it was pretty high priority, pretty important. And he'd been working on it for about 2 days, and he just couldn't get it going. He had the book laying right there. Mm-hmm. where Sergeant Jaco walked out there and looked at it, and he said, move that wire over there. And Strangio says, but the book, I got the illustration right here. The book says, this is right. Jaco says, move that wire over there. And he says, okay, but I warned you. So he moved the wire, put it all together, fired up on the first kick, and ran fine ever after. The manual was wrong. Jaco was right.
Wow.
And he just knew that much about the equipment.
That is fortunate to have someone like that under you, because you can get lots of stuff fixed.
Well, Jaco, we used to have what they called an MOS test. And it was specific to each military specialty. So the generator guys had one, the truck guys, the weapons guys, the signal guys. And Jaco told me one time he thought he could do pretty well on the test and everything except electronics. He thought he'd probably pass electronics, but he wasn't sure he'd do really well.
How do you think he would have done
that? Oh, I think he'd have passed, he'd probably maxed them all except electronics, and he'd probably got 90 in that.
You said earlier, Pat, when you were talking about this transition, that this was one of the most fortunate events of your life, of getting transferred to this particular area, this particular company. Why did you say that?
Well, you know, professionally, I was able to command in Vietnam, in combat as first lieutenant. Mm-hmm. A truly rare and beauteous thing. So that was one thing that worked out for me. You know, it was another of my experiences that I went through, that I wanted to go through. Mm-hmm. It just changed my whole future and my Army career and my life, because I was able to get into the college program and go to school and finish my degree. And it was a great program. All I did for 2 years was go to school.
Right.
I had no military duties. Full paying allowances, paid all my tuition fees and books, everything.
That is a good deal.
Oh, it was a heck of a deal. I mean, you just couldn't beat it. So,
let me ask you this.
Sure.
When did you start thinking career? And I'll let you continue with that story, but was it during college, after college? Was it when you had finally gotten that command in a war?
No, I wasn't thinking of career at that time. The program had not been started when I first took over command.
Okay.
And when it did start, I thought, well, this is an opportunity for me to get my degree. Well, of course, you went to school for 2 years. You were committed to 4 years of service after you graduated.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew I had at least that long to go. If I got in the program, I didn't know what that
right.
I was going to get
right.
in it. But,
I guess you have to look ahead at that.
You have to, because I had to look at my status. You know, I was on what they called an OBV tour, an obligated tour, for 2 years. I would have been done with that when I left Vietnam, meaning I would have gone back to the United States, got discharged.
Right.
Okay. Where I was, no degree, just back from Vietnam, didn't know anybody, didn't know anything, had a wife and a baby, no money. Mm-hmm. You know, what was I going to do?
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't get out. Plus, they started this program, and you had to be voluntary indefinite status to be eligible for the program. So I wasn't thinking career, but I knew that I had to change my status, and I did.
Okay. And that obviously was the right decision.
Yeah. Could not have made a better decision anywhere at any time. And
what about those who had needed more than 2 years to get the degree? Would all they give you was 2 years?
All you could get was 2 years.
Okay. You could only do a certain amount of hours, or you had 2 calendar years?
You had 2 full calendar years.
Okay.
Academic years, actually, but okay. It worked out to be the same thing, because they included summer school. You had to go year-round.
Okay.
And so, yeah, you got 2 years, and I had just over 60 hours of credits, so I was...
Yeah, you're in good shape.
Good shape, not GPA-wise, but good shape credit hours-wise to go into the program. So, and the other criteria was you had to be eligible for a regular Army commission, competitive for a regular Army commission. And, to get back to what you asked me about, I met some fine people. General Hawk was a role model for me in my military career for years and years. And in fact, we were in touch up until just very, very recently, and we kind of lost touch. But until a year or two ago, we were still in touch.
Really?
What happened?
I don't know. We just kind of, yeah, you know, over time. And, mm-hmm. But so you know, it I learned a lot. I learned a lot from Jayco. I learned a lot from General Hawk, and I learned a lot from our battalion XO, Colonel Anderson, and who was also a great guy. I'll tell you the kind of guy Hawk was. And I'll tell you a little war story. I mentioned a war story a minute ago. And,
yeah, I have that here to ask you, actually, about the artillery sites.
Artillery, yeah.
Okay.
I had been in 1st to the 5th Cav, came to 27th Maintenance. Got a call one night. 1st to the 5th Cav was out on a fire base. As they always were, that's where they lived. And the intelligence was that they were going to get a massive ground attack that night.
Okay.
Well, one of your primary weapons in case of a ground attack is a 105 howitzer with direct fire. Mm-hmm. You just lower the tube until it's level with the ground and fire HA or Fourchette or whatever you want to fire. That will definitely slow a charge down. Well, one of their sites had fogged, and they did not have another one. And we did not have one. And this one was, we couldn't fix it, at least not in time. We needed to get it out there. Well, first, it's a long, complicated story, but I'll make it simple. We needed to get a site out to them. And, well, there I was, you know, a young, hard-charging first lieutenant. So I was going to do this myself. So I went and got a helicopter from the brigade headquarters, and I called our operation.
How do you go get a helicopter?
You walk into the brigade talk, tactical operations center. You walk up to the brigade aviation officer. You say, "I'm Lieutenant Curry, and I need a helicopter to do this and such." And he says, "Okay, take this one." And that's exactly the way it happened.
And you like requisition the pilot along.
Well, the pilot comes with the helicopter.
Right. Yeah.
Comes with the helicopter.
It's like I need a taxi out to mm-hmm. the CLZ.
And we didn't have one, so I needed to go back to Benoit to get one.
Okay.
Well, I called back to our operations section on the radio and said, "Here's what I need." And thus and such, and it was after duty hours, and after 5 or 6 at night, this was probably, it was dark, it was probably about 7:38, and
so and they... There's a certain attack that night?
Or? That night.
Wow.
That night. And otherwise, you know, I could have waited till the next day and gone out on a normal long bird.
Sure.
But it they said it couldn't wait, and I took their word for it, you know. And And I'll get back to Lucky again in a minute, but anyway, the guy I talked to in the operations section didn't particularly want to do it, and I said, "Well, you know, tomorrow and all that," and I was trying to tell him, "No, it can't." Now, finally, I called a different guy, and he reluctantly went and got it, and so I took the helicopter, and I flew from where we were at Quan Loi mm-hmm. down to Benoit, and they were waiting at the LZ and had the site.
How big is the site?
Oh, it was in a box probably, about 18 inches long, maybe 12 inches high by 12 inches wide.
Okay.
Not a big thing, but pretty important.
You can carry it in your hands?
Oh, yeah, easily. It didn't weigh hardly anything.
Okay.
But you need it if you're going to fire an artillery piece.
Right.
And know where you're shooting.
Right.
Generally a pretty good idea. And so they were waiting at the LZ and had it, and I got it, and we took off again right away. Kind of interesting, flying over Vietnam at night, you see all the firefights going mm-hmm. on and all that. We were so high, we weren't worried, but see all the firefights going on and all this kind of stuff.
What would you see? The north?
Well, you'd see rifle flashes, flares, artillery rounds going off, mortar rounds going off, you know, the flash from the explosions.
Tracers
going back and forth, green and red, and that kind of stuff. So it was kind of interesting, and that was a real tourist.
Mm-hmm.
And so anyway, we were trucking along, and we had the grid coordinates for the 1st and 5th fire base, and we went out there. Well, the pilots, it turns out, didn't have the radio frequency, they didn't have the call signs, they didn't have any way to get in touch with 1st and 5th. And I mean, we weren't too worried. Obviously, if it was a helicopter, it was good shots.
Sure.
I mean, they weren't going to shoot at us, but since they were expecting a large ground attack imminently, we kind of wanted to get in and out. And since I had been in 1st to the 5th KF, I remembered the radio frequency in the call sign, and they had not changed them.
Okay.
And we don't do it that way nowadays. anyway, they got to the pilots, they called. I got on the radio, told them what was going on.
Were you sitting in the back of the helicopter?
Yes.
Just you?
Just me. And the door gunners.
Okay.
And the door gunners. And of course, the AC and the pilot up front.
Uh-huh.
And so we came in over the fire base, and they shot a flare for us. And we were outside the wire. It was too small for us to land inside the wire. And so we said, okay, here we come. Well, as we started down, we got to a certain altitude, and we were coming as straight down as we could.
Mm-hmm.
And a guy came running out from the wire. And I mean, he was hoofing. And I don't blame him.
Who? What kind of guy?
Oh, one of the guys from 1st to the 5th.
Okay, coming out to get the pieces.
Yeah.
Okay.
And, he had a box in his hands.
Okay.
And we came down, and just as we got to the bottom, he got out to the LZ. I threw my box, and he threw his box. He caught his, and I mean, I don't believe I've seen a guy run that fast. He could have beat Lance Armstrong. Turned around, hoofing it for the wire. I caught our box, and the pilot never even slowed down. He just started up.
Wow.
And we took off and went back to Quantum. So that was kind of an interesting night. But I told you that story just because I was talking about Colonel Hawk.
Yes.
He came out a couple days later and said, well, how are things going? And I said, well, I had a problem. And I told him about it. I guess he went back and just flayed him alive on the grounds that here was a company commander out forward, trying to support the grunts in the field, the artillery in the field, and they had best get off their fat asses and get me what I needed when I needed it. In fact, I didn't even need to need it, I just wanted it.
Right.
Well, boy, I'll tell you what, the head of that section was a major. About 3 days later, here he comes. He says, Lieutenant, if you have any problems with my guys, and I cannot comprehend that you would in the future, but if you do, please call me and don't tell Colonel Hawk. But after that, man, if I needed something, it was on the next bird. I guess he got a hold of that major, who was more or less innocent in the thing.
Sure.
And a couple of his captains just, I mean, ripped their legs off and beat them with it.
Mm-hmm.
But boy, sure got good support after that.
Yeah.
Lost a couple of friends, but...
Well,
but,
you did what you had to do for...
Had to do it. No choice. They had to get it out there. He asked me if I was having a problem, and I was.
Mm-hmm.
So...
I wanted to ask you a general question about yourself. Mm-hmm. How would you describe Lieutenant Pat Curry as a leader? And I know you talked about the Article 15s, but just looking at the XO status and then the company commander status, how would you describe yourself?
You know, there were a couple of basic things I always found, regardless of whether it was lieutenant or lieutenant colonel,
mm-hmm.
there was a couple of basic things that if you did them and were consistent, mm-hmm. that you were going to be a good leader and you were going to have a good unit. And I want to emphasize consistency. If you are not consistent, it just confuses the hell out of people because they don't know what to expect. But one is, you know, there's not a lot of gray. It's black or it's white, you know. It's right or it's wrong. If I tell you to do something and you don't think it's right, you should express your opinion. And then whatever decision the commander makes, you do. Discipline. If you are following an order, a legal order,
mm-hmm.
And I want to emphasize a legal order, and then you do it. And if you don't do it, then you should expect the consequences. And as a leader, it's my job to impose those consequences. And the spate of Article 15s came from them learning to understand that I was going to impose those consequences.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it is your choice whether you follow the rule or not. But if you don't, there's going to be consequences. No ifs, ands, buts, or maybes, period, end of discussion. Okay? Zero tolerance. And care about your folks. Take care of them.
You know, there are some things, given the nature of armies, that young enlisted soldiers can't do for themselves. And you need to help them do those things.
Can you give me an example?
Yeah. I had one scumbag who, which is the polite term, who stole another guy's typewriter and started writing letters to hit the guy's wife. Yeah, I thought this was reasonably low. And so the guy finally came and told me about it. And I got the company in formation. I mean, right that minute, got the company in formation. Didn't wait for nothing. Got them all out there and said, I know who it is. All I'm waiting for is a chance to prove it. And when I prove it, I'm going to put you under LBJ. Dismissed. And about an hour later, the kid comes in and says, my typewriter just showed up on my bunk. And his wife never got another letter. And that showed him that I cared. And I did. It wasn't an act.
Sure.
I don't think that's something that you can fake. I was genuinely outraged. And I never did catch the guy, but I wish I had. But that showed everybody in the company that Curry gives a damn. Mm-hmm. And they, as a result of that, they would take that extra step. They would do that. Maybe they hadn't been specifically instructed to do it, but they would go ahead and take that extra step. Mm-hmm. So one of the things I never told anybody, especially Colonel Hawk, was Strangio and his committee. I mentioned Pop Strangio came in, and for Strangio, the world was divided into O's and E's. There was officers and there was enlisted. I was an O, he was an E, and that's the way the world was. Mm-hmm. Although all things considered, we got to be pretty good friends. But the day before I turned over command, he and his little committee came in and made me an honorary E.
That's not a lot.
And they gave me a little Spec 5 pen, and the fatigues had a flap on the pocket. And so I took that pen and put it underneath the flap where it couldn't be seen. Right. And I wore that during my change of command.
Oh, really?
Yep. Yeah.
And they knew it.
And they knew it. And it was a great honor. You made an honorary E. It was a great honor.
Usually there's a pretty big gulf between the two parties.
There usually is. And Strangio told me, he said, I like it. He said, it's straightforward. I know if I mess up that I'm going to pay the consequences. He says, I like it that way.
Mm-hmm. So, the boundaries.
The boundaries, yeah. Everybody understood what the rules were. Mm-hmm. Hit one guy, I'll never forget. It was pretty quick after I got there. First cab had a very strict rule against beer in the barracks. I'm not saying how strictly it was enforced, but it was a pretty strict rule. And it was enforced in my company. And I was in one of the barracks just walking through, and a guy walked in the other end and had beer in each hand. You talk about deer in the headlights. He knew he was dead meat. And he was.
What'd you do?
I gave him an Article 15. Find him. Of course, no point in restricting anybody.
Right.
I have nowhere to go anyway. But we had a little company club, and I restricted him from that.
Tell me about doing an Article 15. How did you go about doing that?
Well, I mentioned that Article 15 is non-judicial punishment, and it is punishment that a commander can impose on a subordinate. Mm-hmm.
And it goes on your record.
And it... it does no.
It's not part of your.
It's record. Not part of your permanent record because it's non-judicial.
Okay.
The way it works is commander decides and usually talks to the first sergeant, at least if he's smart. So and so did this, and he deserves an Article 15. Or the first sergeant comes in and says, so and so did this, he deserves an Article 15. Mm-hmm. Smart company commander is going to back up his first sergeant. And so you decide what you're going to charge him with, what element of the Uniform Code of Military Justice he violated and what you're going to charge him with. The seriousness determines whether it's an Article 15 or it goes to court-martial. Article 15 is for relatively minor offenses. If it's anything at all serious, it's going to go to court-martial. But if it's a relatively minor thing, like being so dumb you walk into the billets or in the barracks with beer in your hand when the company commander's in there, then it's going to go to an Article 15.
And it's a really good tool for the company commander because you can get their attention without permanently damaging them.
Right.
So anyway, there's obviously it's the Army. There's paperwork. There's forms that you fill out. You call the guy in, and you read him his rights. There's a form that has his rights on him, and you read them to him. And one of the things you advise him is that he can turn down the Article 15. And I say he because in Vietnam all we had were guys. He can turn down the Article 15 and demand a trial by court-martial. My personal philosophy was never offer a guy an Article 15 if you can't prove it in court. I mean, that's just a matter of credibility.
Right.
Because if one guy turns it down and demands a court-martial, and either you don't take it to a court-martial or he beats the court-martial, everybody's going to decline every Article 15 from then on. And that's not in my best interest or theirs, because a court-martial is a federal conviction.
Right.
Follows them around the rest of their life. Mm-hmm. And that's a bad thing. So anyway, you read them their rights, you ask them if they want to accept the Article 15, you give them X hours to think about it. And they come back and they say yes or no. If they say no, you say thank you, you'll be hearing from me. You start the process of court-martial. If they say yes, you give them a chance to say what they want to say, explain matters of mitigation and extenuation, if you will.
Is it just the two of you in the office?
No, the first sergeant is always there. You always have a witness. Always. And it's always the first sergeant. So. And he gets to explain, you explain what he did wrong again, and he gets to explain why he did it. And although with the guy with the beer, all he said was, I was stupid. I agree with
him. What can he say?
What can he say? The first sergeant and I both agreed with him. And then you impose punishment. Well, at this point, he still has the right to refuse it. And so you give him X hours to think about it. He comes back and either declines, processes court-martial, or accepts. And he signs the Article 15, and you process it. And they take the money out of his pay if there's a firing. He's reduced. He gets reduced. And actually, the first guy ever reduced in the Army was a guy named Curry.
Really?
Yep.
What did you reduce him for? Do you remember?
Gosh, I don't remember. I really don't
remember. That's pretty serious.
Getting busted is pretty serious. Even in Vietnam, where rank came fairly fast, getting busted is pretty serious. You're kind of taking two big steps backwards.
How would they have this not follow them around? Because obviously the paperwork goes through, there's a paper trail, people know about it, word of mouth. Mm-hmm.
It went in their local record for a certain period of time and then was in the part of their file that nobody else could see.
Okay.
Yeah. So a guy might come to me and have five Article 15s and I might never know it.
Are you going to ask?
No.
You're not going to call his past commander and say, hey, tell me about it.
Not unless there were some exceptional circumstances. He might come in and he's got one strike in a space where four used to be or something like that. But even then, probably wouldn't.
You're giving him the benefit of the doubt, basically.
Yeah.
Fresh start.
Yeah. Okay. Most of the time. Not always, but most of the time. And especially in Vietnam, I mean, his past commander was probably back in the States. And although I did get a couple of what we call rehab transfers. We had, Quang Hoi was the worst physical location in terms of the conditions. So if somebody really seriously screwed up, they sent him to Quang Hoi.
Why do you say that about Quang Hoi?
It was didn't have nearly the facilities that the other places did. Dust was just, I mean, it would be pouring rain. And for 18 inches off the ground, there'd be a dust storm from the rain beating up the dust.
Wow.
Leavenworth Armored Cab had a site right across the street from us, and their tracks would just chew up that street. And I mean, the dust would be literally 20 inches deep, just like talcum powder. Mm-hmm. They used to come down, spray it down with diesel to try and keep it down. It was in everything. And it was this red. It's a lot like West Texas red. And it was real red. And it's funny, once a month I'd go back to Benoit for our company commander's conference with the battalion commander. Mm-hmm. Hot shower. Hot puppies. I'd go in and stand in the hot shower, and we had a shower. Mm-hmm. You know, it was an old container, metal container of some kind, just mm-hmm. gravity fed. Mm-hmm. But I'd go back and get an actual hot shower in a real shower. And even though I had a shower every day, there would be this ring of red mud around me in the shower as it got out of the creases and pores in my skin and out of my hair. And I mean, this is, wow. So I did get a few rehab transfers. Guys that had screwed up elsewhere. And they were going to give them a fresh start in my company. And you know, I mean, that was just the way it was done. I didn't take that personally or anything. So.
Right. Let me ask you one more thing before we stop. Tell me about, you kept saying that you learned so much doing this. Can you comment just briefly for now, and we'll go into some more detail later. What did you learn there in this 6 months of your tour? What were some of the major overall, looking back, lessons of this particular time period?
Well, watching General Hawk, I think I really learned a lot about leadership. I certainly learned things that I used throughout my career. I think perhaps more importantly, I learned from General Hawk what it really meant to be an Army officer, a professional Army officer. And I say from Colonel Hawk, but his command sergeant major was, I think I mentioned before, was Sergeant Major Grinda, Casimir Grinda. And I mean, look up Sergeant Major in the dictionary, and there is Sergeant Major Grinda's picture.
G-R-I-N-D-A.
G-R-E-N-D-A.
Okay.
Casimir, C-A-S-I-M-I-R, and he was just, I mean, he looked, Sergeant Major Grinda looked, I mean, got us 40 years later, and I still call him Sergeant Major, just looked like a soldier. He had the short, cropped, steel gray hair, you know, he was real lean, and kind of muscular, and had that very erect bearing, you know, and just, I never saw him let down. I'm sure he did. But he never did it around an officer. He was just old school.
What did you learn from him?
He would he'd come in and say, "Sir, I hear he's got, you know, more time in the pay line than I have in the Army," as the cliche mm-hmm. goes. But he always called me sir. Was always very respectful. Said, "Sir, would you have a moment to step outside so we could talk?" And I always did, being no fool. And he would take me outside and tell me his suggestions and comments, and never, you need to do this, never did that, how to deal with the NCOs. You know, as a young man, I admit to being a little intimidated sometimes.
Sure.
And he would give me hints on how to deal with the NCOs and specific NCOs that I might be having difficulty with, or they might. And it was never just hit them between the eyes with the ball peen hammer. It was always some good way of dealing with them, bring them in and counsel them, or sit down and have a beer with them, or some good way of dealing with them.
Right.
And so I learned a lot about dealing with NCOs from him.
Do you remember some of the specific examples or some of the things he might ask me to talk to you about and what you say?
Well,
or just an example of
I had one staff sergeant, who was the supply guy, and ran the warehouse that we had and the supplies and all. And he was having a little problem with alcohol and a little problem with family at home, and et cetera. And Sergeant Major kind of alerted me to this. And I mean, you know, there you are. You're a lot closer in age to the junior enlisted guys.
Yeah.
Than you are the NCOs. Mm-hmm. And so you tended to know a lot more about the personal lives of the junior enlisted guys than you did the NCOs, who certainly were not going to come, generally speaking, talk to some 24-year-old, you know, first lieutenant.
Right.
But told me about the problems he was having and suggested that maybe he needed to go back to Benoit for a few days and just get a little rest and get away from it for a few days. And that the suggestion would be really better if it came from the company commander. And so we did that, and I think it did the guy a lot of good. We being first sergeant, I.
Mm-hmm.
And anything that I ever did with NCOs, I did with the first sergeant. I mean, that was, for one thing, it was smart because he knew a lot. For another thing, he deserved that mm-hmm. from his position. Mm-hmm. And so that was one of the things that, you know, he could have said just, you know, the guy's drinking too much, hammer him and get him out. And there was a lot of that feeling around, but he did it a smart way. And he was always so tactful about it, you know.
You still remember that to this day?
I still remember that, and I remember him to this day. And, you know, I didn't understand the OER system. This was General Hawk. I didn't understand the OER system. And the OER system, less so now, but at that time was very inflated. Mm-hmm. You know, you got numerical ratings in several areas and comments and an overall numerical rating.
Right.
And if you got less than about a 98, I mean, you were doomed. And there was, and still is, a system where you could convey your feelings without, you know, giving the guy a 12 or something. Well, I had this one lieutenant that worked for me, and allegedly, and he just really wasn't very much enjoying what we were doing, and just wasn't very much participating in what we were doing.
This is a second lieutenant?
No, he's a first lieutenant, but he's junior to me.
Let's see.
And, I mean, you know, rank among lieutenants, like virtue among whores and all that. But anyway, I was company commander, and I more or less expected that he would do to me as I would have done to him had our positions been reversed.
Mm-hmm.
And but he was really kind of a dud, and just not very aggressive, not doing much.
Mm-hmm.
Way too close to the enlisted men. I mean, buddies, pals, and that was a non-starter. And so anyway, I wrote him an appropriate OER. This was the time, or one of the times, General Hawk got off the helicopter when I didn't know he was coming and said, I'm going to talk and you're going to listen. He had this OER in his hand. And he said, Lieutenant, if I process this OER, we're both going to be relieved for not having this guy shot.
By the way you wrote it.
By the way I wrote it.
Okay.
I just wrote it straightforward and honest.
Right.
You know, I gave him a 72 and said, you know, he's a moron. And General Hawk took that opportunity to educate me on the intricacies of the officer efficiency reporting system.
What were they?
And that, well, you don't give a guy a 72. You know, you should have relieved him long before, relieved him for cause long before you ever gave him an OER like that. And that, you know, you give him numbers in this range, you know, like a 96.
Mm-hmm.
And then you write your words. It's really an art. You write your words so that it conveys the meaning to anybody who's reading it without actually coming right out and say it.
It sounds like writing citations for the medals, the awards.
And how very much so.
And how you wrote up what they reported from the field, but you turned it into a language that was acceptable and...
Exactly. That's a good way. That's a good analogy. If there's a protocol that you follow, and I wasn't aware of the protocol, and I hadn't had half a dozen myself, and hadn't seen any others,
mm-hmm.
I just had no idea of it. But he took that opportunity to educate me. He was forceful, but not. He didn't chew my butt or anything like that. But he certainly conveyed his idea.
He gave it back to you and said, "Hey, let's try this again."
Yeah, and we did. So, but the one time I got to educate Colonel Hawk or General Hawk, I got another lieutenant in, a second lieutenant, Chuck Case, and Chuck was just fireball, just couldn't learn fast enough, couldn't do enough,
mm-hmm.
and just a pleasure to work with him. And, we had to give up an officer to go to another division. And so General Hawk came up on one of his visits, and he was up there all the time. And he said, "Well, we have to give up an officer." He says, "Case is the newest guy, and so I think we're going to have to send him to the 9th ID." And I said, "Sir, I have a better idea," because I had this other guy,
mm-hmm. the 72 guy.
So I had this other guy, and I said, "I have a much better idea than that." Hawk says, "Lieutenant, sometimes you're smarter than I am."
And so Case stayed.
Case stayed, and the other guy went. And everybody was happy. So
solved your problem.
Solved your problem.
Yeah.
I later heard they were about as glad to have him in the 9th ID as I was.
Wow.
But so that's one time I got to educate General Hawk, Colonel then. But
yes, yes.
So
well, we can continue.
And fortunately, pardon me, I'm sorry. Fortunately, Hawk was the kind of guy that you could say that to. You know, he wasn't the kind of guy you were so scared of that you just said yes sir to anything he said. He didn't lead that way. Mm-hmm. I felt perfectly comfortable saying, sir, I have a better idea. I had no qualms about that whatsoever, and I didn't ever cross my mind that he would chew my butt or...
Right.
I mean, I didn't expect him necessarily to do it,
sure,
but I knew he'd listen.
That says a lot about him.
It does. It really does.
And is that what you took into your future as an officer?
Well, you bet. I always tried to listen. I'm not going to say I always succeeded, but I always tried to listen.
That's a good place where we can stop.
Okay.
And we'll continue with our next session. Thanks
a lot, Pat.